The following is brought to you by the Shining Wizards Network, available on iTunes, Stitcher, Audioboo, and at swn.shiningwizards.com.
When I listen to Turnbuckle Throwbacks with Phil Rea, I don't fall asleep at the wheel like the Junkyard Dog.
The recognized symbol of excellence in sports entertainment.
The Shining Wizards Network proudly presents
the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast
with your hosts,
the Impact Playa, Phil Rea, and Dave Mega Powers.
That was not Led Zeppelin.
Especially with that sexy sax.
With the sexy sax. I don't think Zeppelin had a saxophone or a horn section for that matter. Ladies and gentlemen, from the current to the way back, you are listening to the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. As always, your gracious host, the Impact Player, Mr. Phil Rea, and I am joined by
the original Ghetto Blaster. Coming from out of every amps and speakers in the hood,
it's the Mega Powers. The Mega Powers. You know what's great? No one in our circle anymore calls you Dave. No one.
That's how I wanted.
My wife just greeted him as Mega Powers. That was funny.
And your kid calls me Mega Powers.
And I put Michael to bed. I said, listen, I got stuff to do. He goes, is Mega Powers coming? I'm like, yes. Why, yes, he is.
That's how I like it. I don't want people to know my real name. I want people to think it's a fake name.
Of course, we're on the Shining Wizards Network. ShiningWizardsNetwork.com is the place. RantEMRadio.com is also our home base. And shout out to Audioboo and Buzzsprout and all that good stuff. How you been, brother?
I've been doing all right. Things are moving and grooving and hanging and banging.
Weather sucks lately in the Northeast.
Oh, it's winter in New York. What do you expect?
You know what? And I was telling a couple of guys last night, I don't care about the winter. I love the winter. I just hate being a homeowner and have to shovel that crap out.
Oh, God. Listen, winter, back the fuck up.
Yeah, really. Ease back.
Yeah,
boy.
Easy. I don't want to talk too much about the weather, but last winter, it was warm. There wasn't
any
snow.
Some mild winters the last couple of years. And the great Paul Erling from the Royal Warriors said, and I quote, a lot of people talk about the weather, but no one ever does anything about it.
So that's why I bought a bunch of guns and bazooka and a flamethrower to teach winter lesson this year.
Pretty much. All right, so if you guys listened to the rant last night exclusively on RantEMRadio.com.
So the rant is exclusively on the rant now?
Yeah, of course it is. It's their show. It's their network. Every Tuesday, 8 p.m., AA, Tony C, and The Surfer were on last night.
The Surfer.
Yeah, he's got the What Are You Reading show on The Rant. It's about comic books. It's a pretty cool show. Check out all the shows.
So, like, the surfer doesn't talk about, like, the waves or anything like that?
No, not that books. Surfer, my brother. The cosmic surfer, the silver surfer.
That guy exists?
Of course he does. He was the, what do you call it? He was the, what he did was he hunted for planets, for Galactus to eat. You're not a comic book reader, are you?
I used to be, but I didn't get that into it.
Yeah, I was a geek. I'm still a geek. I'm not even going to lie about it. So, but anyway.
But he was a surfer, and he was looking for planets for people to eat. And
just for Galactus, he was the, he was the guy. You know, he would look for planets for Galactus to eat. And when he found Earth, he was like, you know what? This is a perfect planet, but I have friends there, so don't do it. And then he wound up flipping the script. And
so back the fuck up, Galactus.
Yeah, pretty much. Back the fuck up, planet eater guy.
Yeah, listen, Winter and Galactus, we're coming for you. And I'm not gonna finish the rest of that right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Because this is Black History Month.
Right, it is Black History Month, but we have a huge announcement, like I was getting into before I got into my Silver Surfer.
Does it have something to do with black people?
No, it doesn't. It has to do with us, the show. But, you know, we've been pushing around the idea of going live, and the opportunity has finally come. And starting March 5th, next month, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the Turnbuckle Throwbacks will be a live show.
Wow.
9 to 11. It's, you know, same thing as the live shows. We're going to be taking calls. We're going to be having guests. We're going to have the chat room. So I want to thank AA, Tony C, and the whole crew over at Rant for putting us on. And it doesn't change anything. We're still part of the Wizards. That's our mothership. And we're still with Audio Boo and Stitcher and all the other shit.
And I'm not changing. I'm not selling out.
No, we're not selling out. We're just going live. We're just Dave and I like the interaction with the fans. And the last show put Dave over the top to the point where Dave was like, I want to do this again. And I explored it more.
And nobody says no to me.
You're a funny guy. But even those guys don't call you Dave. Like last night, Tony C was like, so he X'd AA after I logged off. He goes, so did Phil and Mega Powers get a Bret Hart WCW deal? Since you guys were in negotiations. It was pretty funny. They all call you Mega Powers. I love that.
Yeah, so do I. I love it.
All right. So, Dave, we were supposed to have a guest before our
last guest that we were going to add on to our already awesome guest, Anderson Murray from Crowbar Press, who wrote this awesome Bruce Brody book.
Right, and 6 minutes before the show started, we got a text from the commissioner of WPW. The COO. He's like the Triple H of WPW.
So he's the commissioner and the COO.
Pretty much.
Is he also a general manager?
I don't think so. Anthony's got many hats, but I don't know if he's got that many hats. But apparently... Ashley Mazzaro was supposed to come on with us tonight, former WWE diva and Playboy cover gal.
I gotta admit, I'm like so old school, even though I'm not that old. I didn't remember who she was.
She had a punk rock look to her. She had like the pierced lip and...
You're talking to like the original punk rocker, right?
Here. I didn't say like, she was a punk rocker. I said she had a punk rock look.
She had like that Avril Lavigne trying to
right,
punk
exactly. And she was with the guy from Simple Plan for a while. I know she dated Paul London. She dated a few guys, but she was on Survivor China. Didn't even know Survivor went to China. I don't follow the show until I read up on it. So, well, we're gonna have Ashley back. She took ill apparently, so we hope she feels better.
That bastard Winter making people sick.
Yeah,
making
right.
Our guests sick.
Right.
they're taking them away from us. Phil. Why?
I don't know, brother. I have no idea. But we got some news to get into. First, before we get into the news, I mentioned to you in pre-production that there's two anniversaries tonight on this date.
Yeah.
Back in 1989 was the Hogan-Andre Hebner Brothers Switch.
That was no, that wasn't 89. That was
yeah, it was 89. 20
no, it had to be 88.
26 years ago?
Yeah, it was
88. I stand corrected.
That led up to the tournament.
To WrestleMania 5.
So, right. So it was 88.
88, I apologize. I was doing it by memory. I was, and so I saw it on Facebook, and I was trying to do it in my head. So, and in 1994, ECW became, I mean, I know Douglas throwing an NWA title was the start of ECW, but this was the first card.
It all kiss my ass.
That was great. this was the first night the line was crossed in, back in 94. And the main event was a three-way for the world title. It was between Terry Funk, Sabu, and the franchise Shane Douglas.
That was an awesome match.
Honestly, a lot of people shit on Terry Funk, and it's, I don't know why, he's a pretty good wrestler, but even in his old age, he could still go. And this was 20
he's still
years.
Entertaining as hell.
Dude, he was old 20 years ago and could still go, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, he was old when he had the I Quit match with Flair.
Yeah.
At, what's it? No, it wasn't Wrestle War. That's where the feud started. I think it was like a Clash of the Champions or something like that. But he was old then.
Right.
Right. And he was still dishing it out.
His stuff with Flair right before that was good, like Dave mentioned. I don't know. I thought it was good anyway.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into some news. The big talk around town was, of course, CM Punk leaving abruptly.
Taking his ball and going.
Right. A la Austin 2003.
But yeah, people were comparing it to that, but I think it's much different. Especially with this kind of character, too.
And I'm glad you brought that up, partner, because this is a really good segue. JR was recently interviewed, if you don't know who JR is, Jim Ross.
Good old JR.
Good old JR. And they asked him about the current CM Punk situation. He said, and I quote, "The whole locker room has a different feel to it. They're not as edgy as the Attitude Era locker room. Not as competitive. I don't know if they're hungry, but CM Punk is different compared to today's corporate wrestler."
Oh, yeah.
Right, this is what he said. He's a little rogue, and I don't mean that in a negative way. Over the last 3 years, he's been my favorite wrestler to watch in the ring. He would have been a huge star in the Attitude Era. He's cerebral with an old-school spirit that really cares about every aspect of the business. All right, well, there's some validity to that. I think he needed time off, ample time to recharge his batteries. He has a major burnout syndrome, and walking away from a problem is never a solution, so solve the problem.
Yeah, and I think especially nowadays, you know, despite that he might have like an old school mentality, you know, he's still a person living in this era, you know, not just wrestling, but just human beings in general. And, you know, one thing that hasn't changed about pro wrestling and the WWE is the schedule and what they put these dudes through. So I could totally understand the burnout effect and just what these guys go through. You know, after a while, like, you have to question, is it worth it? And from what I understand, you know, this dude's good with his money. He saves it. And, you know, what's next?
Well, why wouldn't he say that? He's a single dude. He has no kids, no family to speak of, except in the DVD he has, like, the people he lived with as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, why wouldn't he bank his money? But that's not my issue, and I told you this last week. My issue is, and I'm a sports guy, you know that. I have a problem with guys under contract holding out for certain reasons. And on the other spectrum, guys hold out for more money while they're under contract. It's not like, well, you didn't put me in the lineup today, coach, so I'm just going to pick my bat up and leave. He's doing the same thing. Well, I'm not headlining WrestleMania. I'm not winning the Royal Rumble. I have no problem with Batista, but I'm going to talk shit about him anyway because they brought him back and he's out of shape and he's not.
And he looks like a shaved gerbil.
But they knew what they were getting. It wasn't like a thing where they surprised anybody. They've been plugging his appearance for a month. And creative of course, runs things by the top talent. Whether they agree with the superstar or not, it's not their call. So if you're unhappy, play your contract out, which I believe is up in July.
Yeah.
And go. Leave. I mean, and guys, really, on the Facebook page, this is for JP and some other guys. Enough with the MMA shit. All right? I don't care what you tell me. I don't think he can hang 3 minutes in the ring with any mixed martial artist in his weight class.
Hey, he's been training with the Gracies and Al Bundy.
But so is everybody else, though. Every other fucking celebrity hangs out and works with the Gracies now. There's 1,700 Gracies, Dave. It's not like there's three Gracies. They have, like, camps everywhere.
Yeah, and there's a couple that are in New Japan.
I'm taking nothing away from the Gracie family. They revolutionized the sport of mixed martial arts, and I have no disrespect to any of those guys. But really, you're in your mid-30s. You're one of the top guys in your industry. If you're not happy with creative, play your contract out and go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Go to Japan. I hate to say it, but see what TNA has to offer. I mean, there's not many options. You're going to go back to Ring of Honor? Or it's not the same Ring of Honor when you were there. Go to Pro Wrestling Guerrilla. Go to Chikara, which is back in May.
New Japan.
Yeah, speaking of Chikara, Chikara's back.
Yeah. Look at the sweatshirt that I'm wearing.
I'm so stoked that my wife wants to take the kid to, like, the Crayola factory, which is in Easton, PA.
And that's where Chikara's returning.
Of course. So I told her, do it the weekend of May 24th. So we can hit the Chikara show on the way home.
I think that's where I actually did the one day of training with them in Easton.
Yeah. I didn't know you. Wait a minute. You did training with them?
Yeah, it's just for like a day. It was like a tryout.
No, you never told me that.
Well, I'm telling you right now.
I love Chikara. The kid loves Chikara. It's a great promotion.
Well, I'll share my class photo on the group page later tonight. But it was awesome. It was I just did it because a friend of mine's brother wanted to give it a shot, and this was a big deal to him to become a pro wrestler. And he didn't know anything about Chikara or the Independents, and I was like, you got to check these guys out because you can go to any there's a lot of people offering pro wrestling training nowadays, and I was like, if you want the legit stuff, you got to go to Chikara, and they're doing the tryout. It was like their first like public. Kind of try out whoever, impressed them the most, got like a free ride into the Wrestle Factory, which is the sweatshirt that I'm wearing right now.
Right.
And so he gave it a shot, and it was just burning in my head. I was like, I want to give this a shot too, just for that one day.
Of course.
There's no obligations or anything like that, and a lot of people were thinking that way too, and it was fucking fun. And I'll say this. At that point in time, I was going to the gym quite often, I wasn't slouching on that. And when I went there, I did the training, and I was like, okay, that wasn't, too bad, because they were just having us, like, do squats and push-ups and stuff like that, and they had us in the ring doing a few bumps here and there and rolling around, like, a lot of calisthenics. And afterwards, I was like, that wasn't that bad. There was one guy who puked, and I was like, oh, I don't know why that guy puked. But then the next day, my body was in immense pain. I didn't think it was that bad, but the rest of the week, I was walking like a mummy. So even like the smallest things, in my opinion, not in everybody else's opinion, just rolling with that, like I didn't think I was going to be in that much pain for the next week.
But that's cool that you got to experience that, though,
And it was awesome that I got to do it in Chikara ring. And funny enough, Mike Quackenbush recognized my name. He's like, oh, I've seen your name on some lists and all that kind of stuff. I was like, oh, yeah, that's me.
Awesome. Well, they're back. May 24th is their first card in Easton, PA. Children under 12 get in free with a paid adult ticket. Which is even more of an incentive. I think the
like a friggin' 12-year-old or younger is gonna go into a wrestling show by himself.
Right. But my kid, I took him last year, and he absolutely loved it. Like, he loved it. And it was a big tournament that day, like a big tag team tournament, like a
It's like King of Trios.
Not King of Trios. It wasn't a tag team. It was like a 10-on-10, almost like Survivor Series style.
Oh, the Cybernetico.
Right.
Okay.
Took him to that with the headliner being Eddie Kingston and I think Gran Hamada.
As the grand champion?
Yeah, for the grand. Eddie Kingston was the grand champion at that point.
I think he's been the only champion, so.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, he got to hang out with Mr. Touchdown, who the Wizards had on last night, I believe.
And he would, they picked him from Beyond Wrestling when I was working with Beyond Wrestling.
Right. And
he's wrestling as Mark Angel.
Yep. And Dasher Hatfield took a picture with him. We got a real good, like, legit mask from Mexico that day. It was cool. Yeah. The wrestlers are very friendly.
One thing I could say about Chikara, as opposed to a lot of other independents, like they know how to treat the fans, and their promotion is just top notch.
Yeah, we're big fans of Chikara, so we're expecting to go to that show. I'm excited.
Yeah, I think I may make an appearance at that show too.
That's cool. All right, so the Turnbuckle Throwbacks will be there now
in the house.
Speaking of independent promotions. This has been the buzz all day on social media and on the internet. WWE did a piece on how Ring of Honor influenced WWE. And
they actually named them?
Dude, they did a whole article.
Wow.
And name dropped everybody, including Colt Cabana, Gabe Sapolsky, Seth Rollins, Cesaro, Punk, Daniel Bryan. And they interviewed all these guys, as you can see with the article. Go to WWE.com. It's called Inside the Indie Influence. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Again.
Well, they took all their best guys at the height of Ring of Honor.
They did, but they didn't, because there was that transition. I got into the company right as Kairi Silken took over, like 2006, I think it was. Mm.
And plus, that's the thing, these guys can't be wrestling on the indies all their life. You know, everybody's goal, for the most part, is to get to the WWE.
Right.
Because how, you know, even if you're not a big WWE guy, you know, like Loki, for instance, he was not, like, that was not a big goal of his, but he knew, I'm sure, to some extent, that he had to go there to further his career so he could just do whatever the hell he wanted to, you know?
And, again, I mentioned this a couple of shows ago, that the road to the top show is way different now. It wasn't just you go from territory to territory and they get signed. Now they have these schools, and they have developmental, and they have all this other crap.
Yeah, you got to be at the right place at the right time.
And you have to have a certain look. I'm sorry. You have to have a certain look.
Yeah.
Listen. A good example, the American Wolves just got a major tryout with WWE before they showed up on TNA. And what happened? They didn't get in. Are they great? They're fantastic. Are they have an excellent moveset? Yeah. Maybe there's something. They're looking for something. You're never going to know what that something is unless you're on the inside.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. There's no in between with that. And what were you going to say?
Well, that's the thing. You know, it's all about the it factor. It's, you know, this is a strange time in wrestling. And, you know, regardless of how things are or whatever, you know, WWE's always on the hunt for the next it guy. And if it's not CM Punk, then who is it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
If it's not Daniel Bryan, who are they going to get instead of him, you know?
Right. I get it. Again, it's just, I thought it was cool giving ROH props. I thought so anyway.
Yeah, that's, back in the day, that would be like an extremely rare thing. Like, they wouldn't mention WCW. They wouldn't talk about NWA or any of that kind of stuff. And even if they had, like the All Japan match between Hogan and Stan Hansen, they wouldn't say anything about All Japan. They just, like, hey, this is a Hogan match. It was... In Japan, we're putting it on our World Tour Coliseum video, and it's Cowboy Stan Hansen that he's doing against, and that's it. And we're not going to talk about his past or anything like that. It just is what it is, and enjoy.
And in this day and age, I think it's not only cool that WWE does that, But I think inadvertently it's going to open a door. Even though they're not looking, Triple H has already said he's not looking for indie guys. Mm-hmm. He's not looking. But there's going to be a guy that comes through their system that somebody may see on TV.
Yeah.
Maybe Vince walks by a monitor and he sees, you know, he sees the Briscoes or he sees Adam Cole. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Maybe, or he sees Kevin Steen.
Well, who was the one dude that was in the Rumble from NXT that they put in there?
Oh, that the Bulgarian guy. I forgot his name already.
Yeah, but that was still like a big thing too. Even though NXT let me rephrase myself. Even though it's a part of WWE, it's not something that they tout about or talk about on the main shows. So it's, you know, it's just a big step that they're trying to, you know, connect all these pieces, and it's okay for fans to know. Like, hey, we're working with these people or something like that. Granted, it's not like a cross-promotional thing like ECW. I haven't forgotten about that.
Right.
But yeah, this is a very interesting time. And I think they're just trying to, you know, put all their pieces together because they're realizing, like, hey, we're, for the most part, they're the only show in town. In my opinion, you can only count TNA for so much, but... you know, with the network coming on, and they have all these different promotions that are a part of the network, you know, it doesn't hurt for them to talk about NXT, which is their own product, or even mention, like, hey, we got these guys from Ring of Honor, and we want to have a good relationship with these guys, you know?
Oh, well, they've been doing that for the last 2 years. They had Bo Dallas in last year's NXT, you know, and he's their world champion now, I think. NXT cast... one of the other podcasts we listen to. Guys, correct me. I don't watch NXT on a regular. I think he was the champion. I'm not sure.
I think he still is, too. It's like the longest reigning NXT champion, but NXT hasn't been around that long. So.
No, but they're doing big things. Yeah. And, again, this network is going to open us up to more conversation about those guys, because I know you would dig that show.
Oh, yeah. From the episodes that I saw, they were fantastic, and a lot of the stuff I was digging was the Cesaro-Sami Zayn feud.
Oh, that was the best match last year, I thought.
Yeah, that will... For me, period, that was, like, the best match.
Dude, that was...
It was really fantastic. It was old school as hell, and still had, you know, the modern sensibilities to it. And, you know, these guys are talented. Why not showcase that? And but the thing is, it's on, like, Hulu, which I don't mind. It's actually for free. You can just go onto the website and watch NXT whatever matches or whatever episodes. It's there. But I don't think about it because it's on Hulu and I don't really go on that site for anything, you know?
Yeah, no.
So I forget about it.
Right. I hear you. I do the same thing.
And I'm sure a lot of people forget about it too, but since the network is coming out, pardon me, and they're going to have NXT episodes on there, it's not going to be sure to remember it. You won't have to put it in your phones and set off bells and whistles to remind you it's on.
Right, right. All right, let's move on. Eric Bischoff is starting a weekly radio show later on this year. How do you feel?
He's back.
He's been around. He's just him and that Jason Hervey guy have been doing production stuff.
Oh, my God. That guy?
Yeah, the Wonder Years guy. They're doing, like, production stuff. But he's doing a weekly show, a radio show.
I don't know. Jason Hervey comes off like the douchiest person on the planet ever.
Dude.
Him and Scott Baio.
Dude. Jason Hervey would be ringside as a kid at the WCW matches.
With Frank and Hooker.
Right, yeah. And you're right, he's a creep. Even on the Wonder Years, he was a creep.
Yeah, Wayne and Butthead and all that.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And I don't know, like, anytime the guy's been on camera or, you know, has just been himself, it's just kind of like, oh my God. And the fact that he was a little bit involved with WCW, I think, like, towards the end, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I had the effects on the microphone. So the first 28 minutes is me and Dave with the fucking sexy voice.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Go ahead.
But, I don't know. I don't like that Butthead at all.
That's crazy.
As you were saying.
Yeah, no, he's getting his own show, so... again, it's radio, it's internet radio. Of course I'm going to listen.
And JR has his own show too, right?
Yeah, it's starting up soon too. So
I'm excited about that.
I'm very excited about
this is an old school show, and I like to hear from old school talent. I'd like to hear those stories.
But Dave, even Bischoff is an old school guy. He started off
as an AWA.
Yeah, he started off as an announcer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a lowly announcer.
He was like a backstage guy. Like, they just put him on camera because they had nobody else this one day. Yeah. So
they had to stick Bischoff on the camera, and look at where he turned up.
Dude, he stepped. Talk about right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Right?
Because from what I remember, the dude wasn't really doing anything but that.
Right.
Exactly. If I remember correctly.
No, he wasn't. He was like a backstage hand. He was like in the office doing administrative stuff.
And I think like even some of those those AWA tapes, like the Hogan one that you had for a bit. I think he was like hosting it, and he was like hosting these videos.
He was.
When AWA was like a dying thing. They had turkeys on poles. And Sergeant Slaughter saying, get the turkey.
Yeah, then when I got cable in the early 90s, ESPN would replay the and play the current AWA stuff before they folded.
From the Showboat Casino.
And Eric Bischoff was a part of that. And they had like these tournaments, like the points. They're like point tournaments, you know. Colonel
like
DeBeer.
The Round Robins or something like that.
It was like Colonel. They had teams. It was almost like Survivor Series, except it was just points. It wasn't like elimination.
Wouldn't that be a hell of a thing to have a Colonel DeBeer's episode during Black History Month?
I'm going to say no. We promised a Yardbird-free month to Tony C and the Rant guys. So no Yardbird in this month. We're going legit Black History Month.
Yeah.
Interesting news. Coming out today also, Extreme Rules, the Extreme Rules pay-per-view will be May 4th in Dave's hometown in the Izod Center in beautiful East Rutherford, New Jersey.
I wasn't born there, but...
You weren't born in Jersey?
I was born in Jersey, but not at the Izod Center.
It's in your hometown, though. It's New Jersey, you know? How far
home state.
Home state, I'm sorry. I stand corrected. In beautiful...
Not everybody's proud to be a resident of Newark.
The Garden State. Oh, you're from Newark?
No. I'm not from Newark.
Okay.
I'm by Newark, but...
Okay. Well, it's in Dave's home state of New Jersey, formerly the Meadowlands Arena, the Brendan Byrne Arena for some of us who are older. Former home of the New Jersey Devils. The Extreme Rules pay-per-view will be there May 4th.
Oh.
And if you have WWE Network, you don't have to go and see it. You just come.
You pay $10, and you know. I feel like we're advertising this. We should be talking more about Crowbar Press and all these other guys.
We will be. Speaking of,
we are excited to watch all those old WCW events.
Of course we are, dude. Somebody on our Facebook page. We'll get to the questions in a minute. Put all the stuff that they're listing right now. Currently, when the network hits on the 24th.
Yeah,
dude, that list is amazing. I think Scott, our buddy Scott from the Facebook page, posted it up there.
Yeah,
shout out to Scott. All right, Kenta will not be signing with the WWE. We mentioned on the last show he was getting a tryout, and his dream was to go to WWE at one point. But he mentioned in a recent press conference that he was pro Noah for life. The tryout was not formal. He wanted to work in a WWE environment and see where it went.
Mm.
So he's going back to Noah to kick major ass. As only Kenta would do.
Kicking people in the face.
He's a face kicker, that guy. He's a habitual face kicker.
Yeah.
There's talks of this is interesting. They want to make The Miz and Ziggler a tag team.
What?
Ziggler cut a crazy promo on a SmackDown tapings, like a legit shoot, saying like he goes out there every night, he performs, and he's not looked at, and he's not respected.
He's been saying that for a while.
Well, now he's saying it on camera.
Yeah.
And it didn't get any bad press or anything, but they're pushing towards this disgruntled wrestler tag team. It worked for The Miz when he was with R-Truth a couple of years ago when they had the feud with Punk and The Rock and Survivor Series and all the other
shit. It's like you're talking a different language to me.
For our current people who follow the current product, I like The Miz in a tag team setting. I don't like him as a singles guy. He grew on me a little bit. I'm not a big fan. I know you're not a big fan of Ziggler.
No, right? I'm a huge fan.
I'm sorry. Would you?
I don't like The Miz, though.
You don't like The Miz. I'm sorry. Right.
Miz is all right.
He's
I'll give him credit for, you know, he caught a lot of flack for being the MTV guy. And he's done a lot of work to, you know, make himself as legit as possible. But for me, you know, it's just not my style of wrestler.
Well,
know?
That was my that was a good segue because I was going to say this guy didn't even like he'd use another avenue to get in and pretty much solidified his spot.
Yeah,
and he married a hot piece. So
good God,
good God. All right. Speaking of disgruntled wrestlers, Alberto Del Rio is not happy with his current role, and he may retire and go to Mexico. Retire or go to Mexico when his contract's up later on this year. Here's a guy that came in like Barnstormers, Dave. He went out. He won the Rumble. Won both championship belts on each brand.
Big buildup, everything.
The lineage of his
Dos Caras.
Yeah, his. Of his family.
Heavy MMA background, too.
Not a big fan of his. Liked him better as a heel, not as a face. But he's playing it smart. He's going to play his role. He's going to then decide. He's not going to walk away like CM Punk did.
Well, you know, I think we should even ask Emerson about this because this is, you know, very similar to the Brody story. But, well, not totally similar, but... You know, a lot of that, there's just a lot of disgruntled dudes. They're not happy how they're being treated. And, you know, some are handling it well, some aren't.
Well, I'm going to tell you this. Bruiser Brody, after reading the book, and we'll get into his stuff in a minute, but you can't compare now to what he did because it wouldn't fly now at all.
Oh, no.
No. Like, he's not going to go into TNA. And be even TNA and get stiffed.
Yeah.
You know, he could still maybe do that in Japan, but even still, the politics different now.
Well, with Brody, he, you know, he knew where his bread was buttered. So whatever, and that was Japan. Right. So he did everything that he could to just maintain that. Everything else was just secondary. Not even secondary. He treated everything, well, almost everything. Just as like, hey, you know, this is just complete business. I just want my money. If you want to screw around with it, then, you know, I'll put a guy in a headlock for 45 minutes and destroy your territory and move on.
Okay. Well, again, we'll get into Brody in about 30 minutes when Mr. Murray calls. All right. We got some caller questions. Not caller questions. They're Facebook questions.
Facebook questions.
Noel wants to know, besides inflating his bank balance, what was the point of bringing Brock Lesnar back? Unless he goes against Taker this year, it's been a total waste of time. I don't know if you're aware, Noel, but he was paid on a appearance basis. So I think he only got paid to show up X amount of times. So they're going to work him into whatever storyline they want for Mania. I don't know if he signed past Mania. I know last year when he was signed past Mania, he had a phenomenal match with John Cena at, I think it was Over the Limit or Extreme. I mean, they put on a clinic. It was a really good match. I'm a Brock Lesnar guy, so maybe I'm the wrong guy to answer this, but honestly, I'd like to see him fight Taker. They're pushing him towards Batista. I think the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view is going to, you know, square out a whole bunch of things. Now with CM Punk not being in the picture, allegedly, that may change. The card is not set in stone. I know they're having a hard time legit. That's from what I'm hearing. So...
And plus, since Brock's been back, it's been kind of like they've either been doing some amazing things or just kind of like, you know, what the hell's the deal?
Yeah, right. Our buddy Dave should answer this question, actually.
A Dave question or Mega Powers question.
Yeah, this is for Mega Powers. Actually, there's two questions here for you on his thread.
Oh, okay.
The first one is, should Murray Hodgson be inducted in the WWE Hall of Fame?
Yeah, why not?
The poor guy. Let's not rehash those conspiracy theories again.
give him his own wing on the Hall of Fame.
And Scott, our buddy Scott. Shout out to Scott, by the way. Discussion with Mega Powers has got me wondering your thoughts on this, Dave. Will the WWE Network remove all traces of Benoit? I seriously hope not. He had some great matches.
Well, didn't they say already that they're going to put disclaimers on for Benoit whenever he pops up?
That's right.
Just my thoughts in general. And, you know, a bunch of the Facebook guys saw me yesterday trying to figure out what match was like – Benoit really laying those chops into Flair.
That would be 2004, sir.
Yeah, well, I found it. It took me forever to find it. Like, those were some insane chops. And I'll say this, you know, everybody's got their opinion on, you know, what Benoit did. We don't have to rehash that. But still, the man's a phenomenal wrestler. And, you know, I didn't care for, you know how he handled his... handle his shit, you know, for his last days on Earth. But his matches are phenomenal. I love watching them. I love watching him chop Ric Flair like he's trying to just put his hand through his goddamn chest. But, you know, I want to see those Benoit matches. I want to see them in good quality. Like today, you know, I had a little break for myself and watched the Iron Man match that he had with Triple H. And it was phenomenal.
Right. I thought his stuff with Booker T was great with the best of seven.
Yeah.
That was fantastic. And listen, I've seen Chris Benoit live in ECW, in WCW, and WWE all mm-hmm. live. And I seen him in the Garden in WWE mm-hmm. when they weren't selling nothing, when half the arena was empty, and he put on clinics.
Yeah, and I saw him in the Garden with a submission match with Chris Jericho, and it was my favorite match. Well, favorite match of the night.
Yeah, you mentioned that, right.
Along with seeing Flair bleeding like crazy in a cage match.
Right.
But he's just, you know, just as, you know, wrestling fans, wrestling historians and all that kind of stuff, you can't downplay what he contributed to pro wrestling. And, you know, for people who want to learn their craft or who just appreciate the sport of professional wrestling, you know, you got to keep those matches around in some extent. I know, you know, some people aren't clear. Is WWE trying to erase his history? Well, there was that one CM Punk, you know, panel discussion at so like San Diego Comic-Con or something like that. And somebody asked him the question, you know, is WWE trying to erase Chris Benoit? And he just put it out there. It's like they're not trying to erase Chris Benoit's history. They're just not trying to promote it or advertise it, which is completely you know, understandable. If he's in a match of some historical, you know, significance, they're going to try to downplay it just so they don't have to, you know, have those discussions come up. You know, they're trying to market their brand, you know, for families again. And, you know, why have that discussion coming up over and over and over again? So in the meantime, you know, they're just not going to advertise him or put his name out there on DVDs and Blu-rays and stuff like that. But he will be a part of the network, which is a cool thing. And just enjoy the matches and, you know, see him for the performer and not for, you know, what he became.
I'm going to go on record and make one comparison to him.
Go for it.
His personal stuff, and that's O.J. Simpson. I mean, if
O.J.?
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to anybody who's a football guy, a girl, fan, I should say, and, you know, this guy was a Hall of Fame running back. Like, he was one of the greatest running backs of all time.
He was great in the Naked Gun movies, too.
He was fantastic in the Naked Gun movies. But, you know, then the whole thing happened in 94, and he makes his wife a Pez dispenser, pretty much, and kills her friend, too, and gets off. That's just my opinion. It didn't happen. He was acquitted. But there's a guy, you know, that the NFL's not going to promote him, but in the same breath, you can't not acknowledge what he did. I mean, Pete Rose got banned from baseball for betting. Meanwhile, he broke the all-time hit record. He'll never make the Hall of Fame. Different rules, different time of baseball. But when best hitters come up, it always comes up.
Yeah.
So if you give me your top 10, my top 10 favorite wrestlers, Chris Benoit is on my top 10.
Mm.
Because of, I thought it was a fantastic talent. I mean, he was a scumbag in real life. And that's another thing, too, with the internet wrestling community. Sometimes they can't differentiate the person from the character.
Oh, especially if the guy's using his own name as his character.
As his character, yeah. Right. But forget about him, the person. The fan can't differentiate the character from the person, whether it's his real name or not. It's like, you know, again, and I mentioned this, there are guys that I met at, you know, at shows or at a convention or whatever, and they blow me off. it's not going to change the, my their perception of them in the ring. Like, I'm like Raven can eat a bag of dicks.
Mm-hmm.
But in the ring, he was awesome, told a great story, cut phenomenal promos.
But did he was his job better than most guys.
Right, and he was a dick to me the two times I saw him. So, I mean, whatever.
He was all right to me when I met him.
Yeah, maybe he had a bad day. Maybe he just didn't like the way I looked, the way I dressed. I don't know. It doesn't matter.
Put on a nice shirt and a tie when you meet Raven.
I'm wearing a Turnbuckle Throwback shirt, which everybody should buy at prowrestlingtees.com/ Turnbuckle Throwback.
Perfect timing on that one.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I think that's the end of the questions. Every other question was for Mr. Emerson, right?
Yeah.
Did you put Harry's question in?
Oh, yeah. I got Harry's two questions in there.
You got to Mr.
Boy,
Emerson.
Mate.
Yeah, we got a lot of
great. We got your questions in there, Governor.
Yeah, here's the pay-per-view listing for the network. This is crazy.
You don't have to read them all. There's a lot.
I'm not going to read them all, Dave. But you could see they cover everything from even the wrestling classic, dude.
Yeah.
That was a great card.
And what, they gave like a free Cadillac to the Junkyard Dog?
It's actually a Rolls Royce.
Okay, whatever.
Asshole. I liked all the In Your Houses. They were fun.
They were short, too, so.
Yeah, Calgary Stampede. They're even going to show
you know,
the.
Part of me wishes they would have more of the TV shows. Like, I want to see the Mid-South stuff with the
they
Junkyard
will
Dog.
Eventually, yeah. But they're actually going to show Over the Edge.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's wow.
The, yeah.
I saw, well, I don't know about you. I saw that live on pay-per-view.
I was
and
taping
And that was
it.
One of the most awkward nights of
I was taping
life.
It off a Hotbox. I was actually doing some volunteer work on an ambulance, and the person taping it for me had called me and said, Owen Hart just died. And I was like, get out of here.
Yeah.
We'll do that pay-per-view, actually, as a podcast. St. Valentine's Day Massacre, that was with the first showing of Paul White, the big show.
Yeah, the cage match.
The cage match with Austin McMahon.
Yeah, that was great.
That was fun. Yeah, I enjoyed that. Again, and then they go into the whole WCW.
Come on, get to the WCW stuff.
Absolutely.
That's what everybody wants.
Absolutely.
Starcade 91.
That's right. That's right.
Well, they start off with all the Starcades, 83
to 87. And they're edited, too, which I don't have a problem with because even the videotapes are edited, too, so it's like.
Well, wait a second. Didn't a lot of those, like, Starcades were happening at different locations, different days? They had, like, the tours.
The Great American Bash. But speaking of the Great American Bash, WWE is putting out a Best of Great American Bash later on this year.
Nice.
So that should be fun to get. I'm going to get that.
Yeah.
But WrestleWar 90, that was Steamboat and Flair. That was fantastic. Yeah. Capital Combat.
They got the Chi-Town Rumble.
That
was the first in the series of Steamboat.
Steamboat
Flair
and Flair. Yeah, they swapped the belts.
Yeah.
This is all by memory, kids. I'm not Wikipedia now. You know.
No.
I'm happy about the memory I have about.
I was
this
watching
stuff.
Those Steamboat Flair matches.
Aren't they fantastic?
They'd never get old.
No, dude, that's this clinic. Someone asked me, and I think we put it on a Facebook page too. If shout out to Chris Espo from Tattoos and Touchdowns. I'm actually going to be guest hosting on this Sunday, morelikeradio.com, exclusively on morelikeradio.com. That's 10 to noon this Sunday. Espo, someone asked Espo if you were going to introduce somebody to wrestling, what matches would you show them? Now, that's hard for me because I can go decade, I can go genre, I can go Japan, I can go, you know what I'm saying?
You like go all around the world and
pretty
back.
Much, yeah. But I would definitely give him any of those Flair Steamboat matches.
And the funny thing is, you know, Flair and Steamboat both admit that they had better matches. They had hundreds of better matches.
If you read Ric Flair's book, he has a whole chapter about wrestling Ricky Steamboat.
Yeah, and if you go on YouTube, they have a lot of those old matches. There's even one where they had Andre the Giant as a special guest referee. I think it was like for the U.S. title or something.
In NWA, Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, those guys could go back then. They could go in the 80s. They can go in the 90s.
Yeah, but this goes, you know, this covers NWA right before the merger with Turner. Actually, almost about 4 or 5 years before the merger.
Yeah.
I think they merged in like 89 or 90. And it goes all the way to the last one. Which was
Greed.
That was Dusty Rhodes. I'll kiss make it. You kiss my ass. Kiss my ass, Ric Flair.
Oh, my God.
Then they go into ECW, and I didn't like a lot of the ECW pay-per-views. I mean, Bayley Legal was incredible. I thought, anyway, it was one of the best ones. Up until, like, 98, you sold me. After that, it went all downhill. Mm.
I don't know. I enjoyed watching them. It was just, you know, granted, it wasn't the ECW of, like, the mid-90s and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't as controversial. But it was still great wrestling, period.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there was some good matches. And, I was at One Night Stand 2005 with the reunion at the Hammerstein. That was fantastic.
For some reason, December to Dismember is on there.
I actually have that on DVD. Someone gave it to me as a Christmas gift.
I think weren't there only like two good matches, like the Eminem Hardy's match? And,
yeah. I liked Eminem. Good team.
Isn't that one where Joey Mercury had like his nose completely busted?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
Off his face with the ladder.
Yeah. Wow. That would. I mean, again, not. I mean, I let me retract a little bit. Not all the ECW pay per views were terrible, but some of them weren't even passable. Like, they would, of course, they did nothing bad when it came to hyping something.
Yeah,
that was their MO. That's how they got big.
But it's also another thing that I mentioned on the shows before. You know, this was a time when ECW was getting big. That's when WWE was and WCW were pulling out some of their guys. You know, granted, WWF did them the favor, had the ECW invasion on Raw a few times, and, you know, they brought Lawler onto ECW and stuff like that. But then, you know, as ECW was growing, you know, a lot of those guys were moving to WCW, WWE, you know, just because they wanted their careers to flourish and, you know, just be better and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, of course, that meant ECW was going to lose some of their guys, and you had some pay-per-views like, what, the Taz, Tanaka, and what's it called? Mike Awesome three-way match.
Yeah.
And, you know, Taz wasn't even an ECW guy at that point. He was just coming – he just won the belt for a little bit and you know, passed on, all that kind of stuff.
Speaking of the network, they also did a trial run. They actually recorded a Raw pre-show this past Raw for – a trial run for the network.
Okay.
So what you can – it's going to be like ESPN like we talked about.
Yeah.
You can watch like a panel of people like the pre-shows they've been doing for the pay-per-view.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to do that for Raw and SmackDown.
That's cool.
So that's not terrible. I can take that.
But are they going to still keep Raw for like 3 hours?
Probably.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. That's a network thing, dude. I mean USA Network.
Yeah.
You have to understand Raw is the longest running cable television show right now.
And this will be interesting because, you know, when we were younger, you know, there was wrestling on, like, especially during the weekends, like almost like all day. And depending on wherever you lived in the country, wrestling could be on all day. And now we're having stuff like, you know, the WWE Network coming on. And it's just all these different, you know, brands, all these different promotions, you know, at everybody's fingertips. We're in the computer age, Phil. We have arrived.
We have arrived.
And RoboCop is
I just coming. Watched RoboCop today.
The new original. One or the old one?
No, the original. I bought it for $8 on Blu-ray.
Oh.
Yeah.
Let me take you to a rape crisis center.
Dead or alive, you're coming with me.
I watched that at the IFC theater not too long ago. Well, I don't want to say not too long ago. Like it was like a year ago or something like that. And they had like the... They had like a 33mm film. Oh my God, that movie does not get old.
No, I bought it for $7 last week, $7.99
on Blu-ray. Amazing.
Yeah, and I bought it and I watched it this morning actually, because I'm going to go see the new one next week. So
my condolences.
Nah, you know what? I guess I'm getting really nostalgic in my old age.
Well, this whole show is built on nostalgia.
You're fucking right. That's why I started the podcast. But I think. Even with pop culture in the 80s and early 90s, I think it was just a different vibe. And with pro wrestling, you know, to have that told to younger fans, I think I sometimes doesn't even give it justice. I could tell you how great it was. I could tell you I was there. I could tell you what I was experiencing at the time when I was doing. But, you know, to give it to somebody else like we're doing, I think it's a, you know, I think it's a good thing. I think I think we need to educate these young bucks.
And, you know, that's why we're doing the Brody episode. You know, when I heard about Brody, he was already dead. When he died, I was like 4 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was fortunate enough in the dawn of the internet age, you know, when chat rooms were kind of safe. You know, I met a cool guy who, you know, schooled me on Hanson and Brody and all that kind of stuff and went out of his way to make me these mixtapes, like VHS mixtapes of, you know, Brody beating the shit out of Abdullah the Butcher in Puerto Rico and him, Brody, doing a furniture commercial too.
Right.
And all this other great stuff.
My introduction to Bruiser Brody was through any magazine that I picked up at the time, was whether it was PWI, Inside Wrestling. The Wrestling Eye, The Wrestler. But the first time I saw him on television, I was in Tarpon Springs, Florida. It was 1987 or 86. It was right after the Mets won the World Series. So this is 86. I went down to Florida during Christmas break, and I had gotten the Carlos Colon, Abdullah the Butcher, like the AWA style figures. I wish I still had them. And I got them down there. It was the first time I was ever in a Kmart. And they would show Puerto Rico, WWC, and World Class on TV down there.
Yeah.
And I saw Brody, and I was like, wow, this is the guy from my magazines, you know? And the legend of Bruiser Brody, and listen, this is not the only episode of Bruiser Brody we're going to get into. We're just going to cover the book. Dave got a hold of all the stuff from Japan.
New Japan particularly.
New Japan particularly. And that alone can be a podcast of just the matches we pick out of that. Forget about World Class and actually anything with Abdullah the Butcher between World Class, New Japan, All Japan, and where else did they wrestle?
He even wrestled in the WWF.
I'm talking about Abdullah.
Oh, Abdullah. Oh.
Right. But like that stuff. I mean, there's so much to do on Bruiser Brody that it wouldn't be just due to talk to the author of the book and then just not walk away from it. We're going to be doing a lot of Bruiser Brody next.
Yeah. If you pick up this book, which is because I know you were trying to find the book and you couldn't find it. I remember you said you went on Amazon. I actually went on Amazon just out of curiosity. And they have it on there. But there's dudes like selling their copies for like $130.
Right. I just said, let me just borrow the book and read it for 2 days.
Yeah. And I was like, I got it on Crowbar Press, which is, you know, the book's publisher, which does like all these awesome autobiographies and biographies of old school wrestlers. Like Stan Hansen's book is on there. It's called The Last Outlaw. That's on there.
Right.
I found out about Crowbar Press from because I wanted to have a copy of Luthez's Hooker. Because I've been looking for that book like for a while now.
Yeah, you gotta lend me that book. I want to read that.
Oh God, it's a phenomenal read.
Yeah, I want to read that.
And you know, they got other books. They got the Nikita Koloff. They got J.J. Dillon,
who's going to be at the WPW show.
Yeah.
So I want to pick his brain while we're there.
And they have like all these amazing books, even like the Mid-Atlantic title, a book only on this belt and all the people that held it. And it's just like this phenomenal like publisher. I'm like, how the hell did I miss out on this? But, you know, I wanted to pick up the Brody book because we've been talking, you know, since I started on the show, back in July, that we wanted to do a Brody episode.
Yeah.
And I just happened to pick up this book, and I was curious about it because it's not told like in a traditional style. It's told in all the voices of, you know, wrestlers, friends, family, everybody.
So Bruiser Brody, about a year after I get into him, tragically dies, right?
Yeah.
And we all know the story, and we got about 8 minutes before Mr. Murray calls in, and we get this a good segue because, you know, again, no internet, no dirt sheets. This is me reading the wrestling magazines, tape trading, and it was a mystery. Up until I read the book, and we'll get into the book in a few minutes when the author calls in, I was telling Dave this after I read the book. I have a whole new perspective about the man that is Bruiser Brody and the legacy that he left behind in professional wrestling. Mm. The thing is, in the early 2000s, when shoot interviews were the thing.
Everybody was getting interviewed, and they still are.
Right. To this day, they come out almost weekly. Monthly, weekly. I mean, there's
anybody and everybody.
Yes, yeah, Smart Mark, High Spots. They, you know,
RF.
You Shoot, RF Video. Yeah,
K-Fabe, all the kayfabe
commentaries. There's a whole bunch of organizations now. What bothered me the most was that every single person that was either there at the incident or was around at the time had a different spin on it, which is why the book put a lot of things in perspective. Because, like Dave mentioned, it's how it's written. It's just pieces of interviews of people that the author interviewed. It was just like it wasn't like chapter one, his experience. It was chapter one quotes from all the different people that were interviewed, and it's the same people. And what he did was he took pieces of the interview of each person and put it in perspective and in a timeline to leading up to the death, the tragic death of Frank Goodish, a.k.a. Bruiser Brody.
And I think the most interesting part of it all was, and like you said, you know, everybody had a different spin on it. Like you'll literally have a guy say like, oh, he never missed his bookings and he was always a man of his word. And then like the next quote is like, no, this guy was an asshole. He screwed me every chance.
Well, that was Nick Bockwinkel. I think Nick Bockwinkel's interpretation of Bruiser Brody in his book was I think for me, if I could have talked to anybody and just Nick Bockwinkel and then watched Brody's matches, I think he put a lot of things in perspective for me. Because Bockwinkel, you have to understand too, he's one of those guys that stuck to the game, was a phenomenal talent in the ring, was personable, but he was also very loyal to the business.
Yeah.
And not a lot of guys in this book are quote-unquote loyal. And what I mean loyal, I'm talking about guys that stay with one promotion for mostly all their career.
Yeah.
It wasn't like – and I'm not saying that's bad. I'm saying like even as a sports fan, when I was a kid, you didn't see guys leaving baseball teams – guys stuck with the team for a long time.
Yeah, it wasn't. There weren't all these big contract disputes or people holding somebody up for money.
Yeah, and that was another thing. Wrestling was territorial, and we talked about that a million times. Bruiser Brody just didn't want to be labeled. He wanted to go wherever he wanted, did whatever he wanted to do. The best part about that was he was very good at what he did.
Yeah.
So you couldn't really put a belt on him for very long. And if you did, he wasn't going to defend it. And he only worked with certain guys, too, which was there's so many things that I don't like about Bruiser Brody. But there's so many things that I love about Bruiser Brody.
Yeah, and it's why he's, somebody who's still talked about today. And, you know, as far as current pro wrestlers are concerned, you know, he still has an impact on them. And how they operate and how they, you know, try to create their own style.
So, we got about 4 minutes before he's supposed to be calling in, actually. The author lives on the West Coast, so which is why we're talking about Brody leading up to the interview. Is there anything else we should talk about the book specifically before we get into the interview that I think the fans might want, like our insight? Like, I already gave my insight about Nick Bockwinkel, but...
You know, all I can really say, because, you know, a lot of people were asking questions, and me and Emerson kind of a little bit, you know, touched upon this before, and it's kind of like, oh, there's a lot of people that are brand new to Bruiser Brody, and they don't know, a lot of stuff that we've been well-versed in over the years. You know, there's even some of the listeners who's like, you know, I just heard about this guy and I sent him a bunch of videos. And, you know, this book just touches upon everything. It goes from the Luger cage shoot, which for me, you know, kind of like what you mentioned, you know, as far as the mystery or the you know, the tall tales of Bruiser Brody, you know, that was always one of them, the Luger cage match. Because they had this cage match, and Brody, you know, just like a typical match, but then out of nowhere, Brody just, like, stopped selling for the guy. And we all know Luger's punches are, you know, they're like almost on par with the Sid punches. They don't look good.
Exactly.
At all.
Right.
So when you got a guy like Bruiser Brody just like not selling them, it's like, what the fuck's going on? And I've heard so many stories about this match and, you know, why Brody did it. I even heard stories about him putting razor blades inside of his tape on his fingers, and he just showed it to Luger, so Luger just bounced. You know, there's just so much, you know, fiction and so many different spins on Brody, which is also kind of, you know, why this book was put together. You know, there's some guys that knew him, like, so well, but their stories don't completely jive with everybody else's stories, you know?
All right, well, before we get into the video, I'm going to play the promotional video for the book from BruiserBrody.com. So if you guys don't mind, I'll play that right now. Yeah.
Anywhere he went, around the world, Japan, Asia, all over, you know, Europe, South Africa, when he went down there. Anywhere you went, they knew the name Bruiser Brody.
They wanted to see violence, and we give them violence. I mean, if we had to take a bottle and break it over somebody's head or whatever, we'd done it. And we didn't care what we'd done.
Frank Goodish was very private, very to himself, walked to his own drummer both in and out of the business. And didn't necessarily mingle. Frank was not one of the boys.
He said what he thought, and he made a lot of enemies along the way. I mean, he had a lot of enemies in wrestling because he wanted to do things on his terms.
Brody was a good wrestler, but he was more or less my style. He'd pick up a chair, he'd pick up a club, he'd pick up whatever he could get his hands on, that's what Bruiser Brody done. You know what I mean? And in the ring, he was a violent man. Outside the ring, he was a good man.
I don't know if both him and Stan, somebody said that one time the two of them agreed, try to screw over every promoter they could. Whether that's a true thing or not, but it sure seemed like it.
He never went to any one territory. He'd go to all the territories. And just his style, too. It's, you know, so many people that came after him took a piece of his style and molded it into their own style. So he's looked up upon by all the guys that I know.
You know, the 20th century, the greatest, you know, foreigner in the 20th century, and Brody got more.
It's calling it, and it's all you.
Yeah, all right.
Good evening, Turnbuckle Throwbacks.
Hey, is this David?
Phil and Dave, how are you, sir?
Hey, great. How are you guys?
Doing awesome. How are you doing, Emerson?
Good. I just kicked my family out of the house, so
nice.
Other than the dog whining, we should be okay.
Perfect. Well, we're recording right now.
Oh, okay.
So we'll just get right into it. We were just talking about the book we're going over. We're actually just playing the promotional video off of YouTube, so everybody can.
Oh, yeah, it. Yeah. Did you guys just get a copy of the book?
I got my copy in December.
Yeah.
So this is brand new. I didn't know the book came out in 2007. But
it's been around for a while, so it was sort of surprising to get your call. Yeah. It was or your email, but it was interesting because a wrestling Hall of Fame asked me to write a bio like almost the exact same day. So I was like, are these connected? But I guess they're not.
No.
It was weird after all these years.
We're an old school wrestling podcast. And when I did like the first 20 episodes by myself, this is Phil, by the way.
Oh, hey.
And when Dave came on, Dave was is a huge fan of, as I am too, of Japanese wrestling and of the strong style and all of the gaijin that went there. And of course, Bruiser Brody was one of my favorite wrestlers of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a teenager when he passed. And when Dave and I got together, we were swapping videos, and I said to him, I was like, we got to do a show on Brody. Not just one show, but a show. And I think the one book that always came up in conversation was yours. And,
oh, okay.
Well, because, I mean, when people talk about the legacy and the man that was, You know, there's so many different perspectives of him, you know, and, you know, the way you put the book, the way you have it situated is you just interviewed a bunch of people that were around in that time, whether it was family and, you know, coworkers and people he worked with and stuff like that. And then the way it's broken down, it put a whole new perspective on it for me. Because there were certain things I didn't know about him. Like, I didn't know he was a good writer, you know.
Sports.
Yeah, for me, too. I mean, you know, I came at it from the perspective of a fan, for sure. And the real goal – well, first, you know, I wanted to do a film on him, a documentary. And I saved up a few $1,000s and sort of started down that road. And that's kind of what you're watching on YouTube, some footage from that. And that didn't pan out because I kind of jumped into it without really knowing much from the production end. I was mostly in the camera department and lighting. And so that kind of fell apart. And after a while, I thought, well, this just can't die. I have so much good stuff. You know, I had the Abdullah interview. I had the Dory Funk interview, Killer Kowalski. I had a bunch of people. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe this would make a good book. And one of my favorite old books was a documentary or a biography by a guy named Rudolf Gray about the filmmaker Ed Wood. And it was done all in quotes. And I thought, God, well, that, you know, I'm on my way already. I could continue this project and just call people on the phone and do it that way. So that's kind of what I did. The goal was really to make a textbook. I thought, you know, I want to cover this from all angles and have this be, you know, the final sort of word on Bruiser Brody. We'll have all the different angles. We'll cover everything, even the driest, smallest little, you know, 6-month title reign in a small territory, I'll at least mention. So we just get everything, you know, everything we can. So that was sort of the goal of the book once it got started.
And you had an interesting ride with this because what was it when we were talking over the phone not too long ago, and I was reading on your website, you know, putting this book together was a bit challenging, and I was reading about how your manuscript got in the wrong hands. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh yeah, It took 7 years. So I worked on it for 7 years. I started sort of in late 1999, maybe 2000, and it came out in March 2007. I was actually at the hospital. My wife had just given birth to my second daughter, and when I got home, the email had come from Scott Teal from Crowbar Press. Hey, the book is out. So I remember the date pretty well. And yeah, it was pretty eye-opening. Coming from the fan perspective where you think, you know, about storylines and about, you know, just the wrestling business in general. And you don't realize that behind the scenes, there's as much, well, let's just put it this way. It comes from, you know, wrestling, professional wrestling comes from, you know, the carny circuit. So there's a lot of that still in there. I mean, as you guys probably know, as much as me, if not more, there's a lot of sort of shysterism, I guess is what you could say, in the business. And it can, I think I heard Jim Cornette say recently, the wrestling business is full of crazy people and regular people, and the regular people are driven crazy by the crazy people, something like that. I don't know. I'm sorry, I totally rambled. What was the question again?
Just the whole process of putting the book together, and it came out coinciding with was it Larry Matisic's and Barbara Gutisch's
book? Oh yeah, that's kind of a sore spot. But so I had gotten Larry's name from Dave Meltzer. Dave said you need to talk to Larry Matisic because he and Brody were such good friends during, you know, in the St. Louis area and sort of in the late 80s, mid to late 80s. So I got a hold of Larry. We did an amazing hour and a half interview. He gave me so much information. I mean, he's quoted all throughout my book.
Oh, yeah.
And then we did a second, and he said that he was still in touch with Brody's widow, Barbara Goodish. And we did a second interview. It was an hour long, and he said, oh, yeah, I'm trying to contact Barbara. And then the third time I talked to him, he was like kind of rude to me. Like, I'm saying like a lot, huh? That's a California thing.
It's fine, man.
Yeah,
don't worry about it.
We say worse things over on the East Coast.
I'm from Brooklyn, so I speak Brooklynese. So it's
gotcha. You'll have stuff that I'm not familiar with. Right. Okay.
Absolutely.
So I talked to Larry, and Larry said something to the effect of, remember, guys, this was a long time ago.
It's quite all right.
Something to the effect of, Barbara doesn't want to talk to you. She has no interest in talking with you. So you need to just let that go. And he had been so friendly with me before, so I thought, whoa, geez, okay, this is kind of weird. He had put me in contact with some other people, too, from the St. Louis area that that were kind of, how do I want to put this?
Any way you want. This is no
hold. Yeah, well, they had been friendly with Bruiser Brody. Let's put
okay.
it this way.
Okay. Colleagues.
They had been women that had been extremely friendly with Bruiser Brody.
Gotcha.
And these were people that, Larry had put me in touch with. So I thought, oh, okay, that's cool. And then, for some reason, I got like this weird feeling that I had done something wrong or something had – I had blown something with Barbara Goodish, even though I had never met her, never talked to her. Really, I knew she was in Florida somewhere, and that was about it. So I thought, okay, I'll just drop it. I'll leave Larry alone. There's something going on. I don't understand what's going on. And then a couple months later, I was actually contacted by somebody from ECW Press, and they said, oh, hey, it sounds like you got this great project going on. I don't really want to say the person's name, but this great project going on, and why don't you send me something? And I said, well, I'll send you the whole manuscript, everything I have. I mean, this is me being naive. That's totally my fault. I'll send you the whole thing, everything I have, but really it's just a jumble of quotes right now. I haven't filled in anything. This is back when the project had about half as many interviews as it ended up with. There's a lot of gaps. So I send it off. They send it back saying, hey, this thing's just a jumble of quotes. We're not interested. Yeah, it is just a jumble of quotes. And then a while after that, I got a call that this other book was coming out, that Larry Matisick and Barbara Goodish were coming out with a book through ECW Press. So, I was heartbroken and there was nothing I could do about it. I had given them my manuscript. So the best case scenario is they have the manuscript, and the manuscript is comprised of quotes from other people and history and investigation that I had done. So it's not, it wasn't, how do I want to say it? Like, I don't feel that I could copyright it because it's real history, And that's at best. At worst, they could just rip it off directly and use the quotes themselves, which they didn't end up doing. So it was a real bitter pill, and it stung quite a bit. I was pretty broken by all that, but in the end, I think that their book tells a very different story than mine does. It's from the perspective of his wife, who could know him better, and one of his best friends. So I think most of what Larry says in that book you can find in my book, but I think it's an interesting book. Have you guys read that book?
No,
we haven't.
No,
it's actually pretty good.
I'm sure it is. So you were,
it sits pretty well on the shelf next to my book. I think that they cover
that's
just
cool.
about everything.
So you were a fan, and that's what inspired you to start digging. Well, you were a fan, you want to do the movie first, the documentary, and then turn into a book.
Yeah. So Bruiser Brody was one of my heroes when I was little, maybe like you guys too, So I was working in the film industry and, saving money, but I was doing mostly lighting, like I said, and camera. And I thought, God, I really want to do something that's mine. I'm working on other people's, projects. I want something that's mine. And I was up in my mother's attic going through a bunch of wrestling magazines. And there's, I forget, it's like Wrestling Ringside. It's got Paul Orndorff on the cover, and on the back there's this picture of Bruiser Brody pointing at his face, just screaming in blood. And it was like I always tell people, the angels were like this light shone down, and the angels, oh! And I thought, oh shit, this is what I'm gonna do. So, it just popped like that, and so I just started trying to contact people, and Jimmy Snuka was the first one to come back, and Dory Funk quickly emailed me back, and that's sort of how it started.
Actually, before you called, me and Phil were trading our stories about how we, our favorite Brody moments. So I guess the segue into, getting into more like details about Brody, like what was your absolute favorite Brody moment? Because I know in the book, you cover some of his matches, like the
oh yeah, some of his matches. Okay, so when I was a little kid, I knew Brody mostly from the magazines, but you could catch World Class on ESPN sometimes.
That's funny, because actually Phil was talking.
Say that again?
Actually, before you called, Phil was saying the exact same thing about that. Right. That's how he got into Brody.
Yeah, we didn't get cable. I didn't get cable television on my block in New York City until late 89, early 1990. And ESPN would show reruns of World Class and AWA. So.
And they showed like huge, like, they weren't like little house shows. They were like the big show, the big shows. So. Right. Yeah, there was a time I remember when I was young, we could watch WWF on like Saturday mornings, and then you could watch it on Monday evenings. I forgot what that show was called on USA. It was before Raw. And then you could watch Tuesday Night Titans, the freaking WWF talk show.
Right.
And then you could also get UWF, which was on like after the Morton Downey Jr. show or something. And you could get World Class, you could get AWA, and then Pedicino's show, which had a bunch of different
territories.
Global.
Yeah, the Global Wrestling Federation. Yep.
Yeah. So it was like crazy. There was so much wrestling if you were patient.
If you dug for it, absolutely.
Okay, so my favorite Brody moment when I was a kid was the steel cage match with Abdullah the Butcher. Which was shown on World Class Wrestling, and Fritz Von Erich is the special guest referee. So that to me was like the cream of the crop. I got it. I videotaped it. I had it in SP format. It was just beautiful. I watched it over and over. But as an adult, my favorite one has probably got to be his 2 out of 3 falls match with Ric Flair, that goes to the 60-minute time limit draw.
Yeah.
That's just a beautiful, beautiful match, and. I mean, Ric Flair can pretty much have a beautiful match with anyone, but and there's something about how they left the house lights on for the first fall, where you can just see how huge that St. Louis arena is. I can't remember the name of the arena, but
that's the Kiel Auditorium, I believe.
The Kiel Auditorium, yeah. And so, that's got to be my favorite match.
And that was like one of those few occasions where Brody just kind of showed that he could hang. He wasn't just a brawler.
Right, right. So he didn't, he didn't gas out. He had the repertoire to what was it? One old wrestler, I think it was Bob Roop, that said, "Oh yeah, you have to understand, wrestling is like stand-up comedy. You need to have enough material to do those 60-minute matches. So whether you can physically hang or not, you need to have the material." So and Brody could do that when it called for it.
Yeah, and there's also a quote in the book from Nick Bockwinkel, saying, Brody always had things his way, but if you forced him to wrestle, he would wrestle.
Yeah, and you can find those old tapes. I mean, DVDs or whatever. I'm sure there's torrents now, but where he's wrestling Nick, and he's some of his Japanese matches, and that was one thing that was so great about him was. He could wrestle on whatever level he needed to, and a lot of people don't understand that. The thumping and the brawling, that was a style, that accomplished a goal. It told a story in the ring, and he could tell a different story if he needed to. Mm. It's like Hulk Hogan. If you watch Hulk Hogan's matches in Japan, he's like throwing an armbar, and he has hammer locks.
We just covered one of his.
Over here, nobody wants to see that. You know, he punches someone, and everyone does a backflip. You know, they're so happy.
Dave and I just talked about that a few weeks ago. That Hogan stuff in Japan is awesome.
It's actually really good stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I mean, he was trained by Matsuda, right? So,
yeah.
You know, he has a background in something. Matsuda doesn't, you know, not going to let him walk out of there with, being an idiot. So.
Exactly. And now, you know, we all know Brody is a great performer, but also, you know, he's a bit of a controversial dude. And I think especially with this last month going down, WWE has guys like CM Punk that are just kind of, you know, walking out on their contract. There's like sports figures doing the same, but you know, Brody was doing that before, you know, everybody else was.
Right. You know, he was one of those outlaws. I mean, there was a handful of them there was a lot of outlaws, right, in the 70s and the early 80s. You know, that was a way of life. People traveled through the territories, but. Once in 1983, when Vince McMahon started buying up all the top talent from each territory and sort of globalized everything, there were not as many of those people that could go from territory to territory. You know, Andre got sucked up, so he couldn't do that. Abdullah was one, and Stan Hansen to some degree was one. But Brody was sort of the king of the outlaws, traveling and making money, you know, go here for a little while, go here for a little while. And you guys, I'm sure, know his reputation with promoters. He pissed them off, and there's just as many stories in the book that go the other way. You know, he'd show up to a house show, and he had been promised one thing, and promoter didn't deliver. The AWA, Vern Gagne, used to advertise him for shows that they knew he wasn't going to be on. So it sort of went both ways, and he was just looking out for himself and to provide for his family. So,
yeah, which is great. And because before you came on, we were talking about the style of the book, and it's, you know, told in so many, you know, different voices, like especially concerning you know, his relationships with promoters, like for instance, was I remember you know, Gary Hart's, you know, one of the few guys that he was cool with.
Yeah.
He was putting him over, saying like, hey, you know, he always kept his word, always did what, you know, he was told. And if he said he was going to be there, he'd be there. But then, like, the next quote, somebody saying he was full of shit. He didn't show up or.
Yeah, it was like Bob Geigel or Harley Race probably or, yeah. He never messed with Sam Muchnick, you know, who was the head of the NWA for so long and so well-respected. Never messed with him. Certainly never really messed with Fritz Von Erich. You know, he even took the book for a while from Fritz. He was always pretty straight with Baba. You know, he jumped for a short time to New Japan and had that series of matches with Inoki, and then, you know, had to really come back on his knees to get back in with Baba, but he did. Dory Funk was the booker at that time and helped him with that. It went back and forth. You know, there were always rumors that he and Stan Hansen said they were going to screw over every promoter in the world or in the country or whatever. But, he did what he had to do. And I think sometimes the fans did have to suffer, you know, the long headlock matches or, you know, the Lex Luger match in the steel cage in Florida. I don't know. I never bashed him. I always felt like, you know, he did what he had to do.
You know, now putting this book together, like how has your opinion of Brody like changed since, you know, being a kid watching him?
Well, a couple of things happened, you know, along the way. You know, I got married and became a dad myself, so I think I ended up sympathizing more with him. One thing you mentioned earlier was Gary Hart. I had no idea what a big part of Brody's life Gary Hart was. I had no idea.
Because he was handling all his bookings and everything.
Yeah, he took care of his bookings for a long time there.
It was like 10 years.
And he worked out of Gary Hart's office, and Gary, you know, provided him with – the previous year's NWA contact booklet. And so they were like really tight with each other. Also, the way Brody handled himself in business, I think it sounds sort of cheesy, but that influenced me. Yeah, I think that's it.
You know, it's in the book, it's so well put. Like Dave was mentioning before, like, you know, there was you say one positive thing about him and then they'll follow up with a negative.
Yeah.
What was your impression of him after the book came out? Like after you got the book put out and now you're a dad and you're not watching wrestling like you used to unless you're a hardcore fan like I am and I'm pushing 40 now, but what was your impression of him after the book was out?
After the book came out, when I watched him, it's sort of weird, but I look at his face and I look at, there's my dog, everything that he's thinking about. And that sort of affects, I watched that in the matches where I never did before. He had a personality, when he was younger, that was sort of pulling pranks and being crazy and wild. And when he got older, I don't know what it was exactly, but he got a lot more serious. And you can sort of see that in his early matches versus his later matches, sort of the change in him. And I sort of look at him a lot more like a person because does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
It makes perfect sense because we were just talking about I don't know if you follow the current product at all, but the WWE is putting out a network.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys on our Facebook page were asking if they're going to put like guys like Chris Benoit on a page.
Right. Well, I already saw, just on their website, I did see some Brody matches.
Right. Well, the thing is,
I mean, they're,
one minute
of a Brody match. But
yeah, no, they are. But the point was, like Dave and I were talking about, some wrestling fans can't differentiate the character from the person when they find out stuff about their real life. Which intertwines with my question to you was, what was your take on him?
Let me finish that a little bit then. Okay, yeah, he was much more calculating than he was the crazy madman. And that's what I can see more. I can see, him thinking and, it's sort of that old thing where, say, Abdullah the Butcher, the more he and Abdullah were crazy and beat the shit out of each other and were wild and slamming each other, the more asses they put in seats and the more money they made. So this craziness and this insanity was all with a purpose and it was all calculated. And it's just aces,
Yeah, because actually there's a I don't want to say a shoot interview because there weren't like shoot interviews at this time. He was still keeping kayfabe, but he's – it's like this half hour shoot interview-esque kind of thing on YouTube. And, he's not, in character or anything like that, but he seemed like a really
mellow. Yeah.
A very
he's still telling stories, though.
Yeah.
Even in that, he's telling stories. You know, I forgot who he said. I think it's in that video. No, maybe I got it from somewhere else. I forgot who he said brought him into the wrestling business. He used to always say this guy's name. It was a football player from Detroit, Walter Johnson? No, I can't remember, but it's been so long. But he kept telling that story, and I went back and I interviewed all the football players. I interviewed all the early wrestlers, the guys that trained him, and it wasn't this guy. So there's, these guys, like I say in the introduction of the book, they're traveling the world and they're living these, these cult-like celebrity lives. And the tall tales just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And sometimes, reality disappears. And that was one of the big challenges of the book in the beginning where I was like, I'm going to take the Dave Meltzer route and try to find only the exact truth. Well, it became almost impossible, like you guys mentioned before, when you see, five guys saying this and then five guys saying the exact opposite thing. It's like the truth sort of dissolves and crumbles underneath the legend and the myth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I sort of took the rule of, you know, if I heard it from two people or more, then it goes in the book. If it's just one guy talking, you know, and there's a few in there, Ox Baker saying that he got the part of, his cameo role in, what was it? Escape from New York. Because Brody died, you know, Brody was the first choice, but he died. Well, you know, Escape from New York was shot in 1985, 1986.
Right.
Brody didn't die until 88. So,
right.
You know, that story had to go in because it's kind of an interesting story. But for the most part, I tried to really stick to, you know, hey, can I get this corroborated from a handful of people?
Yeah. It's easier to call people out on stuff now because of the,
For sure.
Because of the internet and stuff like that. So.
Right. Everybody's talking about the Ric Flair thing right now. So he did that shoot interview and he's talking about Brody's death in 1986, which it actually was in 1988.
Right.
And how he was there and, you know, all the records indicate he was actually up in the States wrestling that night.
That's what was so great about the book, because now as podcasters, we listen to other podcasts. And last year, around right before Dave jumped on with me, I had listened to a Dutch Mantel interview on, I believe it was Colt Cabana's podcast. And, you know, very intriguing guy, still in the business, you know, and he's done a lot. He's been a promoter, he's been a manager, he's been a wrestler. He's done almost everything in the game. And he had a connection to this whole thing. But every single time he said something about the incident, which we'll lead up to in a few minutes, it was like it wasn't the same thing.
Yeah.
And it baffled me. So when I read the book last month with Dave, it was like I immediately called Dave. I was like, dude, this is what I was talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Hold on. Let me stop you for one sec. Yeah. Specifically with Dutch Mantel. You know, I did go on to a message board. He came on, and I asked him about it, and he just shot me down. You know, he was like, that is incredibly rude of you to ask, or something like that. And okay, sorry, sir. But I had an audio tape interview with him on an airplane where he goes over the incident. So I knew that was him, and so I used that. But he also has an account of the incident that is online that he wrote, I guess, and which is a totally different story. And then I'm basically reiterating what you just said. But and then I've heard, him interviewed on YouTube videos, totally different stories. So, you know, Ric Flair is not there and saying he's there. And Dutch Mantel, who was there, is suddenly out catching a breath of fresh air when the event happened. And it's like, you just have to stick.
Yeah. I thought it was hilarious.
You put it in there, and other people will agree with him, and other people will disagree with his version of things. And then, you know, that's what it is. So
I thought it was hilarious that Flair said not only that he was there, but when he heard the news, he was just sitting in the locker room waiting for his match.
I don't even understand it. I mean, I get it. Like, so I'm on the spot right now. I feel like I am, doing an interview with you guys, and I might say something kind of weird or something might slip out, and I mean, I wish I wouldn't have said that. But that is such a huge thing.
Yeah.
That's like, that is just. I don't even want to pretend to think what was, to say what was going through his head. I have no idea. It was interesting.
Yeah, that's like such a strange thing for him to say. Like even him saying that he was there when he wasn't there, but saying that he played it safe and just stayed in the locker room and didn't bother with it. That's even crazier.
That is crazy. Yeah.
One of our listeners, and I guess this goes in line with what we're talking about right now, Baza Smith asked. He wanted us to ask you about Tony Atlas regarding Bruiser Brody's death, and in particular regarding his refusal to offer testimony. And that's another thing.
Well,
I heard him say something different, that he was never contacted to.
Story was always, from the day, from the event, was that they didn't contact him until too late. And Dutch Mantel said the same thing. I think Tony Atlas was scared to go down there, and I or to go back, and I I don't know. I had a couple interviews with Tony, and each time I talked to him, he said, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about it. And then we'd end up talking for 2 hours. But, and he would tell me that he was afraid to go back. But then later he told me that he did go back and that he was in the same room with Jose Gonzalez. And so I don't know what, why he didn't go back or what was going through his head. And I don't want to sort of make that conjecture.
Yeah.
But,
plus it seemed like a lot of guys were, you know, once that happened, they were just kind of turned off to the experience, but then there were guys that were still going, like,
you know,
Abdullah the Butcher.
Yeah. They're just like, I'm done. I'm not going back. Abdullah went back. He was friends with Carlos Colon for years and years. You know, obviously, Dutch Mantel went back and ended up booking. I don't think he ever worked in the same company with Jose Gonzalez again. But, you know, certainly he made a fine career down there. So.
Yeah. And, well, a lot of, actually a few of our listeners were asking, you know, what was like the general consensus about like how people thought about the death from his, you know, fellow coworkers to his family and just friends and all that kind of stuff. Do you want to
about the why of the death? You think?
I guess like
this is from one of your listeners.
Yeah, I guess like a little bit about the why, as well as you know, just the general reaction of after.
I think the reaction was mostly shock. I think people sort of drop their petty differences when something like that happens.
Yeah.
The why is. In my opinion, you know, it started back in 1976 when they were both wrestling for the WWWF, and Brody, you know, came in, and here was Gonzalez, you know, fresh-faced, you know, baby face and you know, making his way. Brody came in and sort of just kicked ass over everybody. There was one incident in the Nassau Coliseum where he beat the shit out of Jose Gonzalez. The story has it that his lip was hanging off his face.
Yeah, that story was actually talked about a lot as a kid growing up in the 80s. And
oh, interesting. Uh-huh.
After he, but I didn't get it, though, till after he passed.
That's what I was going to ask. So was the story told? The story was not told before he passed?
No, because the legacy got huge after he passed. And this is, again, this is me being 12, 13 years old.
Right.
Not having the internet, not having a dirt sheet. It was just, at this point, pen pal, tape trading, no cable TV, and just wrestling magazines.
Yeah. So that was an incident that I've heard over and over. Then there's other incidents that are thrown out, you know, whether Jose Gonzalez's young daughter drowned in a puddle or something, or had been electrocuted. I had heard that his brother had just been killed. So he was undergoing a lot of stress right before. You know, which of those is true, I'm not exactly certain. But and then that he was the number two baby face in the WWC in Cologne's organization. He had always been. He bled for Cologne. He, you know, he looked up to him, and he idolized Cologne almost. And here comes Brody from the States, this guy that he had had trouble with earlier, and kicked his ass, and, you know, maybe he took his spot, I don't know. But here comes Brody, and he most certainly took a lot of he came in as a heel, wrestled as a heel, and then he made the switch to babyface, and boom. All of this glory goes away from Invader. And Invader also was given the book, and he I don't know if he was – yeah, he was the booker. And God, so much of this is slipping out of my head over the years. He was the booker, and he would come up with story ideas and finishes to matches, and Brody would just ignore him. And Brody would put him down, from what I've heard, at every turn. And nobody took him very seriously, and I think he just got really fed up with that, whatever other personal issues were going on in his life, I'm not sure. And that's – that's what happened. That's what I think is the reason why. Now there's other stories that you know, that they were in there operating on him. Oh, it's a simple knife wound. And suddenly the doctors were all dismissed and Brody was left in a room by himself. I've never found big conspiracy. You know, I haven't been able to corroborate that stuff. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But I was never able to corroborate those stories. We did have one incident where we were trying to contact the courts down there, and down in the basement, I guess, is where they have all the records. And my wife and I spent 2 days trying, she speaks Spanish, and we're trying to call them to get the records. We kept getting shifted around. We actually have a piece of paper with all the craziness, and we're getting shifted over here and sent over here, call over here. We finally get a lady down in the records in the basement, and we're saying, we're looking for these court records. And we tell her the case and all this stuff. And she says, oh, I'll go pull the case case file. And we say, okay, great. She said, call me back later this afternoon or something. So we hang up. We call her back. And she's whispering. And she says, the case file is supposed to be there, but it's not. Don't ever call here again. And hangs up. And we're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Just a, you know, just like the cherry on the sundae of the Bruiser Brody thing. Like, what the fuck? So, no. I don't know. You know, people, I'm not big on conspiracies, but I don't know.
Do you know if, like, Carlos Colon or, you know, WWC had any political
connections? I've heard from many people. You know, he runs that island. Mm-hmm. You know, he has shills that know where you are at all times.
I want to just, yeah.
You're not going to get off the island unless it's okay with him. Emerson, stuff like that. You know.
I want to touch on Carlos Colon real quick.
Yeah.
The more in depth we got into the book, like towards the end, right after his death and before his death, I think you just hit the nail on the head in terms of Carlos politically, you know, flexing his muscle in terms of covering this all up. Do you think he had a hand in the events leading up to the incident? Like, do you think he knew the invader was mad at him and stuff like that?
I think
that?
He knew he was mad at him. It would be hard for me to believe that he knew he was planning to kill him. There were other rumors I heard where Brody had bought part of the company and they were going to cut him out. But Brody was bringing in so much money for them, and I mean, what do you think? You think you're gonna kill this guy in a shower and your business isn't going to drop? The other American wrestlers are going to be like, oh, that – man, that sucks. Yeah, we always kind of didn't like Brody. He was always fighting, and you know, I mean, fuck that. That would be crazy. Yeah. So not to call you crazy or anything, because I have heard that many times. I don't think that that Colon knew the extent or knew what was going to happen. But I do think that Colon, you know, made things better for himself and Invader after it happened. You know, I think that he flexed his muscle.
I mean, let's be honest. I mean, Brody's death impacted both Puerto Rico and Japan, like, drastically.
Yeah.
Because of the booking and because of his presence. I mean, Japan, Dave was mentioning a few weeks ago, they, like, mourned. Like, it was, like, a big deal over there.
Oh, it was huge. Yeah, so, it was absolutely huge.
You know, and then wrestlers stopped coming to Puerto Rico. I mean, you mentioned the, you know, Tony Atlas's and Dutch Mantel's of the world, but a lot of the American wrestlers didn't go to Puerto Rico for a long, long time after that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, those guys were the exceptions. You think about all the other wrestlers, you know, those great, and you can still get all the bootlegs or, you know, some of them are officially released, those great 80s matches. That territory was hot, and they had a lot of American wrestlers going down there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would, you know, almost all of them just stopped. You know, it killed their business. It just killed their business.
All right. Well, here's speaking of people that were in the book. Who were the most? I know you mentioned it on the webpage, but who were the most difficult people to talk to? Like, what was it? How hard was like when every time you spoke to them, it was like, oh, like you know, like
yeah.
How like honestly, like who were the hardest people to talk to?
The hardest people for me to call, damn, that's kind of hard. Bill Watts would have been one.
Not surprised.
He just did, you know, he didn't hold back. He did not like Brody.
Yeah, he has some
and
of my favorite quotes.
One time I called him when there was a football game on, and he started cussing at me. So that was kind of sucked. I'm sitting here with friends, and you want me to talk about that asshole or something like that. Gosh.
There's like some people
Harley who- Race was tough for me to talk to because I talked to him in person, and he just did not say much, you know, and I don't think he had a lot of great feelings about Brody, and he didn't know who the hell I was. You know, I was just a nobody. Snuka was really hard because, well, he's Jimmy Snuka, and
we know that.
It's just he doesn't remember a lot.
Yeah.
We know that too.
What's that?
We know that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he talks in like code words, and then he gives you a hug, and then, you know, he gives you the sign, you know, the I love you sign, and then it's just really weird talking to him. Lord James Blears didn't remember who Brody was. That was heartbreaking.
Wow.
Vern Gagne, he was not in any position to be interviewed, so I didn't get to. Okay, who was tough, though? God,
what about Bachwinkle? I loved Bachwinkle.
Oh, my God. No, Bachwinkle was awesome. God, he was so great.
I honestly, between the structure of the book, which was fantastic, and Nick Bachwinkle put it so over the top for me. For some reason, his stuff stood out more. Like,
that's great. And that's all on video. I have the video of that. That was the video interview. He is such
that.
A gentleman. The guy is so well-spoken. He's so intelligent. And I just felt like before our interview, he had really thought about it. And I don't know if you guys have this experience interviewing wrestlers or when you talk to them. A lot of them don't remember your name or take the time to remember your name.
No.
At least for me, you know, I was just a little, you know, fanboy. But he, like, remembered my name and it was just – he was just so sharp, so sharp. Ivan Putski was really hard for me to get a hold of.
That was another thing. Yeah. We didn't know Putski's connection. Like, that's amazing. Like, in New York.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you didn't know the Putski connection. Yeah.
No, that was the thing. Like, Putski was the man up here in New York when I was
Right. Oh, Polish Power. Right, for sure.
Dude, he was like the mid-card, like, champion. Like,
yeah, right. He was like the first Ultimate Warrior or whatever, you know.
Exactly.
Just huge.
So we didn't know the connection. And I was amazed by
Putski. Was a high school PE teacher who had his wife had too many kids, too many girls, and he could not he couldn't live on that salary, so he got into wrestling. Yeah. I love that story. And he knew a lot of those Toros, a lot of those football players down there from the Continental Football League, and he worked out with Bruiser Brody and. I kept trying to get him to come into the ring. He was the one. He was the one that brought him in.
And what was it? I was reading.
He was.
Website.
I called him, the poor man. I used to have Mondays off of work, and so that was my Bruiser Brody day. I called him and Harley Race, these poor guys. I called him every Monday for about 5 years.
I was just about to get to that.
And
that
left a message. And I always pretended like I had never called before. Hi, this is Emerson Murray. I'm writing a book on Bruiser Brody. And I was wondering if you could get that. Finally, one day, after years, Ivan Putski answered the phone.
Wow.
So
it
was
like
that.
Movie? It was like, what? Well, the other funny one was getting a hold of Carlos Colon.
Oh, boy.
Somebody down there had given me the number for WWC or whatever their company is. And I called that number every Monday because he was one of the last ones. So every Monday for 7 years, and the phone just rang and rang and rang and rang. And I was talking to somebody else who's a photographer down there. And I said, yeah, I've been calling this number and it just rings. I don't know who, you know, I don't know what's going on. Is it some front or something? You know, my mind goes crazy thinking about all the shady stuff. And, he gives me the number, and I've been calling one digit off for 7 years.
Wow.
I don't know what the hell number I was calling. But so the first time I call it, I get some tough guy. What do you want? And then I say, I want to talk to Carlos Colon. And my timing was also perfect because they were doing that Bruiser Brody Memorial Cup, which was, I thought, rather disgusting. But so Colon was
the one
actually
Sabu
willing to
won,
talk
right?
to me. What's that?
That's the one at Sabu won, right?
Yeah, the Sabu
first
one. It was like
yeah.
a double ring battle
right.
royal. Or
yeah,
something.
I remember hearing about that. I never saw it.
And then they held it in the arena that he died in.
Yeah, I mean, heard about just, that.
It's
eerie.
Like you, it's like everything wrong with the wrestling business, you know?
Yeah.
But he was willing to talk to me. And I don't remember if he laid down any rules or anything, but we just jumped into it. And he was serious but upbeat. And, you know, I told him, I said, this is first person. I want to hear what you say. I'm not going to twist it around. Also, Invader used to have a website, and he may still. I haven't looked. And you couldn't Google it, which was really weird. And I don't remember how I got it, but I got a bunch of pictures off there, and I emailed him constantly, just constantly, saying, you know, just – you know, even if it's just written, I don't care. I just want your side of the story. I don't – you know, I'm not going to put my own words in there, not going to put any words in your mouth. I just want to hear what you have to say. Because I had heard people have ran into him drunk, and he, you know, kind of like you were talking about earlier, he just had a different story each time and everything. So those are some of my hits and misses.
Now, what about getting Stan Hansen to do the foreword for the...
Stan Hansen, I've still never met. I never talked to him.
Wow.
That was all Scott Teal. Scott Teal ended up being... good buddies with him, and Crowbar has actually released Stan Hansen's biography, or autobiography, excuse me. And so Scott Teal arranged all that. Mm. Yeah, Scott was pretty amazing. You know, after ECW Press screwed me over, I was really thinking about self-publishing because I had a lot of ideas for the book on how it was going to look. And that I wanted color pages, but I didn't want like one little color section in the middle of the book. And I wanted to design it myself and, you know, tons of pictures, square bound, you know, square shaped. And I really didn't want anything on the cover except for a picture of Bruiser Brody. But because I thought, well, it's going to be, you know, I'm going to be selling it online. So no matter where the picture is, it's going right next to it is going to be the words Bruiser Brody, you know, click here, no matter where it is. So, but anyway, Scott Teal from Crowbar Press got in touch with me and, I said, I want this, 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 and this. And he said, okay. And, he was amazing in getting the book published. And he had a ton. If you look at the credits at the beginning, he helped out with a ton of interviews. He really added a lot to the book.
Yeah, and he seemed like he was able to get a lot of guys for you that they were just kind of, you know, yeah, messing you up and all that kind of stuff.
And the cover photo is from Scott Romer, who is a photographer. And I picked that because I thought it's a black and white photo that I turned, you know, sort of sepia tone. I thought it's just a perfect Brody picture. He's covered in blood, but it's black and white, you know, so my mom's not going to puke.
Right.
And he's by himself. He's, you know, sitting there looking thoughtful by himself, covered in blood. It was just like it showed both sides of him so perfectly, I thought.
Mm. Now, I guess we've had you on for like almost an hour, so we're going to.
Oh, sorry.
No, we're not sorry.
We can keep going if you want.
We don't want to keep you. We just, you know, there's so many things. I mean, it's such a fascinating story, and he's such a great – he was such a great performer that, that you know –
this interview can be 24 hours, and we won't stretch.
Exactly.
Right. Right.
But before we get into the death, I want to just ask you about his wife Barbara and how was the interactions with her prior to the whole other book thing? And
it wasn't. I've never talked to her before.
So that was all Scott then.
No. She's not in the book. The wife that is interviewed in the book is a woman named Marie Neese.
Oh, Marie, I'm sorry, not Barbara. Yeah, I'm sorry. I meant to say.
Yeah, that's
Marie.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, how did I get in touch with her? Maybe through classmates.com? No, I can't remember, but. Oh, no. You know, I found a. It was published online. It was like the divorces in every divorce in Texas.
Wow.
And I found her name. Because I had heard her name from a bunch of the football players. All the football players just loved her. And they just all spoke so highly of her. And so I just, you know, gave it a shot and then searched for her name online and found her. And we communicated through email. So her parts were written by her. and you know, they weren't spoken, and yeah, it just put such a, it was so refreshing to have a female perspective, especially if somebody that was that close to him, you know. That was amazing. That was, to me, that's some of my favorite stuff in the book, when she talks about him and how funny he is and how funny he was and crazy, you know, just the, she made him a peanut, this is so stupid, but she made him a peanut butter and banana sandwich. And then she asked him, "Oh, how'd you like it?" And he said, "Oh, I took it out and threw it on the ground and stepped and smashed it with my foot." I don't know. It's just like, it's just perfect Bruiser Brody kind of stuff, but wrapped in this, you know, unique perspective.
Yeah, because it seemed like everybody had like their own. Well, obviously they had their own take on him, but you know, they would have like drastic ones. Like some people, like for me in particular, I remember Hansen's. I guess they were in the same territory for the first time, and they're like,
oh yeah.
It's like, yeah, we got, you know, Frank Gooding here, and he's like him, and then he's like going off all these wild stories from when they were.
Yeah, he's like that crazy guy, and Brody's like trying to be quiet about, no, shut up, man, I'm trying to be respectable here. Oh, so funny. And then Eddie Greiz, all his stories, you know, they were smoking buddies. They smoked dope together, and that was a totally different, like, what perspective. And then all the Japanese, you know, the Funks, Terry Funk, you know, had the college stories plus the Japanese story, you know, the stories from Japan. Yeah. It really is like so many, different perspectives of him.
So
also interesting how many people that were like, oh, he was so great. You know, we were best buds
Absolute opposite.
Yeah.
Like the destroyer
exactly.
quote.
So I think because he was so straight that, you know, if he showed people a little attention, they just loved him. Mm.
All right, so it's been a couple of years since the book's been out. And
yeah.
I mean, what was the response you got from, like insiders? You know, like the Meltzers of the world and, I mean, the you know.
Well, it got, you know, from Dave Meltzer, I don't know. I don't know that he ever even wrote about it. But he's a big part of it. His interview was amazing. The dude's mind is like a steel trap. He just remembers things so well. I had a lot of really positive feedback. I was worried about, you know, I had published the coroner's report after he passed away. Even that on my website, I had BruiserBrody.com. I had asked, do you think it's appropriate? And overwhelmingly, everyone said, yes, we want, you know, and we want to see it. So I did put it in the book. I thought that would be too much and a little too callous, but I guess it wasn't. I got all good response from that. And I haven't actually got a lot of sort of insider response. A lot of the message boards, I was surprised at how a handful of fans thought the book was very negative towards Bruiser Brody. It was a contingent that seemed to be sort of from St. Louis. This is before Mattisick's book came out, but from St. Louis, and they thought the book was really negative, which sort of surprised me. But, you know, when you're telling a full picture of somebody, I guess it's hard not to be in certain points.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, obviously this book is from 2007 and we're still talking about it now. Like, what do you feel, you know, keeps the legacy of Bruiser Brody alive even to the point now? And, you know, we sent you a bunch of the questions, some of the listeners were sending, and it's...
Well, one thing that pisses me off is the misinformation. The misinformation that is constantly out there on, you know, whether it's Wikipedia or message boards or some of the questions that people send in. It's like the truth is there, you know. You can pick it up and you can read it, but the misinformation just keeps it alive. And I think almost it makes me angry, but at the same time, it's almost beneficial because it's those tall tales and that mythology that keeps it interesting and keeps it crazy. And then you can go and say, oh, well, it's everyone's telling me these, you know, absolutely crazy stories. You go and look at it and say, yeah, it is crazy, but, you know, it was a dude doing what he had to do to feed his family. And the core of it is not all that crazy.
No. All right, so let's get into what are you doing now? Are you doing anything now? Or
no, you know, I started compiling an Andre the Giant book before their biography came out. I thought, gosh, this would be – every person that I talk to has an – you know, in the industry and even fans has an Andre the Giant story. So I thought, God, this format, this sort of first-person or primary source biography would really lend itself to Andre the Giant because he's another larger-than-life kind of icon. And so I started working on that, and then they came out with their own biography, which is kind of watered down, and it doesn't go into some of the great stories. But I always thought that would be a lot of fun. So I have a lot of – not a lot of work on it, but I have some work done. I went back and did more film and video work, and, you know, painting was my first love, so I do a lot of that now.
Mm. So one last question before we send you off. We had some fans asking, you know, how did, you know, did Bruiser Brody affect, you know, the careers of like Mick Foley and the Berserker and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So who's the Berserker? I don't know the Berserker. That's not John Nord, is it?
It is John Nord.
Oh, it is John Nord. Okay. Well, John, that character was clearly just a ripoff of Bruiser Brody. So, and they ended up working together in the AWA. So I have no idea what Bruiser Brody thought of the whole thing, but, you know,
I think it was just
stealing a style, you know, making Harley Race the King, you know, just stealing Jerry Lawler's shtick. So that was a clear ripoff. I don't, you know, Mick Foley, I know that he, one of his favorite wrestlers was Bruiser Brody, and I've seen some great video of him having his teeth worked on with a Bruiser Brody shirt on, talking about how much he loved Bruiser Brody. And he's got like the physical head, you know, he looks like him with the beard and the long hair, but his style is like almost exactly the opposite, I think. You know, his is a take punishment style, whereas Brody's is an issue punishment style. So I never quite got that, but, you know, I can see it.
There was even something interesting in the book, like even Jim Duggan wrestled as Bruiser Brody Jr.
Yeah, see, that's a story that I haven't been able to find a lot of information about. Drives me crazy.
But still, the fact that it happened is
right. Right. Wouldn't it be great though to find like a poster or something? You know, like a card lineup, a program, and it's all Bruiser Brody Jr. I've never found one.
Well, the book is Bruiser Brody by Mr. Emerson Murray, edited by Scott Teal. You can get it on crowballpress.com. It is a fantastic read, and we have a bunch of newer wrestling fans, younger wrestling fans, I should say. Who once Dave and I started mentioning, your book and Brody on the show, they just went completely crazy.
Cool.
Yeah, because again, the legacy that is Bruiser Brody
continues on.
You know what? He's one of those guys, one of those characters that you just can't be replicated. It's not.
No, he was a big man. He was muscle bound. He was huge. But yet he moved super fast. He didn't slow down. He hit the ring. He hit it hard, and he didn't stop. And that style will transcend any era.
Awesome. Absolutely. Is there any last words before we leave you be, Mr. Murray?
No, I just wanted to say thank you, guys. I really appreciate it after all these years. And I really punished myself this week researching because I was surprised at how much has dripped and oozed out of my head the information. If you work on a book for 7 years, and you learn all the stuff that nobody knows about, you're really excited, you publish a book, and then somebody sits down and reads it, and they're just as much an expert as you are.
Well,
that's kind of strange.
Well, we appreciate, you know, your perspective in terms of how the book was put, because I don't think the story can be told any other way now.
Yeah.
Like even though the other book is probably good, that's sitting on your shelf, and I'm sure we'll read it just because we're Brody fans. But honestly, not because you're on the show, but I think no one else now could tell the story the way you did just because of the people that were involved and the people that you had in the book. I think it just puts a different twist on things. So where can fans – are you on social media? Are you doing anything else?
Well, I still have bruiserbrody.com up there.
Okay.
So check that out. Yeah, there's some background on the book. You can there's a link right to Crowbar Press to get there to order the book.
And there's the manga that's on there too, which I was surprised.
Say that again. Sorry.
There's the Brody manga, the comic, the Japanese comic.
Yeah, that's right. I scanned every page. I'd never had anybody translate it, but yeah.
How did you get a hold of it?
That was on an eBay find, and you know, there's actually a second volume. I got a hold of the second volume. I haven't taken pictures of it though or scanned it.
Oh, I need to get a hold of that.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That was one of the biggest shockers for me.
Well, have you ever have you ever heard the Terry Funk album?
Yes. Oh my God. He's singing about being in high school or something. Yeah. The no teachers or something.
Yeah. We love the fact that you're a fan, too. A lot of these guys that write the books, sometimes they're not fans. They just...
Oh, really? Hardcore, old school fan. Not so old school, but like 70s and 80s. Yeah, that's my cup of tea. And
awesome.
The new stuff I'm trying to watch because my nephew's getting into it. So, I don't want to be dumb. And, I saw American Dragon Wrestle, and now he's Bryan Danielson or... Daniel Bryan, or whatever his name is.
Absolutely.
And he was amazing back then, you know, in the early 2000s. And it's so cool to see him. It was one of those guys you thought, oh, they're never going to put him on.
And now he's
almost
guy.
Too good. And there he is. Everyone's bitching about him, not being in the Royal Rumble and stuff. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's so good.
That's crazy.
Well, listen, you're always welcome back. We're going to be doing a bunch of Brody stuff because we're knuckleheads like that. But we really appreciate you coming on tonight with us and talking to
us. For sure. Yeah. So we can get, Blood and Guts Bruiser Brody and civilize him a little bit.
Absolutely.
He did the furniture commercials, too. So.
I know. Those are awesome. The good guys or whatever they are. Yeah.
He's got good style for furniture choice.
I know.
All right. So go to bruiserbrody.com, crowbarpress.com. You can get the stuff there. And once again, Emerson Murray, thank you so much.
Wait a second. Actually, before you let him go.
Okay.
Phil was trying to get a copy of the book on Amazon. I'm like, why are you going to
Holy
Amazon?
Holy shit. Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, no.
Because I saw a copy on there for like $130.
Yeah,
you know, they heard limited edition of 1,000, and somebody, you know, I heard that somebody actually bought 50 copies of the book. Thinking that it was going to be a gold mine. And,
you could get for
that
25.
Was a friend of mine actually named John, but he's from New York too. They're on Amazon for a lot, but you can go to Crowbar Press and order them. We haven't sold out of the first 1,000, so.
And they're like $25.
Yeah,
they're $25. It's great.
Yeah,
you get tons of color pictures. Great stuff.
It's a great read, and honestly, if you're an old school wrestling fan, even if you're not, you want to read about like the legacy that is Bruiser Brody. This is a really good perspective, and Emerson puts it all in there, and it's a great read. So, again, thank you so much for coming on with us. We really love to have you back eventually.
For sure. Okay, take care, guys.
Take care,
Emerson. Have an awesome night, Emerson.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye.
Well, there it is.
That was a fucking awesome interview.
I'm two for two because Greg Klein was a great interview.
Yeah.
With the JYD book, and this is nothing short of brilliant, only because he's a fan. Like, a lot of these guys that write the books aren't fans. They just, they just do research. They see something that inspired them or we're two for two because Klein was a great fan, and so was Emerson. So,
and this man took 7 years of his life, thousands of dollars to make this happen. And some of the things that he didn't mention was that he would actually go out and travel to meet these guys.
So he mentioned it. He mentioned the plane thing, and he mentioned Holly, the whole thing with Holly Race and all the other nonsense. So go to bruiserbrody.com. I want that comic book, dude. That Magna. I got to get that. Can you still get that?
I'm sure you can in some way. I don't know how, but I guess just keep going on eBay or...
Yeah.
I'm sure maybe something on Amazon or something like that. But in the meantime, you can go to Emerson's site, bruiserbrody.com.
And look at bruiserbrody.com and look at the first one,
You won't be able to understand it, but you'll get to see it. And
I just want to check that out again.
And actually, some of the photos are in the book.
Yeah, some of the photos are in the book.
And it is just off the hook.
Like go to bruiserbrody.com. There's a link to Crowbar Press. Like Dave mentioned, they got some good publications there. But the Bruiser Brody book, that's the one book. I mean, like Emerson mentioned, there are other books. But, again, this is a really good read.
So buy it. What are you waiting for?
Yeah, go buy a T-shirt. And then when you get the T-shirt, you're going to be inspired to old school wrestling, and so buy.
And you're going to buy Emerson's book, and you're going to read it while you're wearing our t-shirts.
That's right. That's right. That's right. All right, so let's start wrapping this up because it's been a long night.
Yeah.
We are the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. We are on the Shining Wizards Network, shiningwizardsnetwork.com. We're
soon to be live on the rant.
On the rant, March 5th.
We're live.
Live. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Buzzsprout. Dave mentioned the rant. We are on Geek Life Radio every Saturday evening, 8 p.m. Central Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. So check that out. Audio Boo. And let's see. Let's do some plugs. Of course, we have a wonderful event coming up on March 8th, World Premier Wrestling. Go to WPWWrestling.com at the Resort World Casino in Queens, New York. They're going to have their big card there. It's going to be, let's see, we have, let's see what's going on here. Piper's going to be there with Snuka, the Big O, Ashley Mazzaro, who didn't come on the show tonight. Good job.
One of these days she'll be on.
One of these days she'll be on.
Jimmy Snuka's going to be there.
Okay, brother.
And you can ask him about Brody and some other things, too.
All Money Legal, Bandito Jr., Big Vito Lagrasso, the Grim Reaper, Malta the Damager, Little Guido, our stablemate from Shining Wizards Network, Mr. Justin Credible, Johnny Knockout, Jay Santana, Queen Zone, Matt Stryker, Tony Nese, who we... Yeah, that's right, part of the Bullet Club. Love that shirt, by the way. Matt Morgan, Damian Darling, Brooklyn's Own Amazing Red, Damian DeMonto, Robbie E., Greek God Papadon, who we're going to have on the show in a couple of weeks. Of course, I mentioned Piper Snooker, Cowboy Bob Orton, bunch of broads, and tickets are on sale now. You can get your tickets at WPWWrestling.com.
It's going to be at a casino.
Yeah, Holy Grail autograph signing from 2 to 6. The card starts at 7:30. Doors open 6:45. You can go to the RW New York or WPWWrestling.com to get tickets. All right.
Are you going to be gambling that night?
No, my family is, though. They're big gamblers. Like my
Even
wife's
Mikey's going to be gambling?
No, we can't let Mikey in the casino.
You got to start him out early, man.
Nah, we'll get him in Piper's Pit. But no, listen to our network brothers, of course, the Midnight Jury. Our brothers, the Shining Wizards, Neck Breakers, 2.5 podcasts. Shout out to Kevin Matthews, who's in India right now. 2.5.
Is he wrestling for Ring Cock King or something?
No, he's doing some Wrestling Mania 10 with Cole Cabana and a bunch of other guys.
Wrestling's huge in India.
It's huge in India. They had a huge thing for him, like a big billboard and stuff.
Oh,
so
my God.
Good shout out to Kevin. All those Fallen Angels. You know, Stickman, Apex Radio, Wolfman Jack Foley, Lopez, support Dan Hanson, Dan Lopez.
Shout out to the world.
Shout out to the world. Geeks of the Industry, Bloke Show, NXT, Cast, Don Tony, Kevin Castle, Wrestling Soup.
And big up to our listeners.
And to everybody on the Facebook page, thank you so much for your love.
I'm getting caught up in the Facebook page. Like, I have stuff to do during the day.
I'm so happy that you interact with the fans, dude. It's so cool.
I love
cool.
The fans.
The fans are fantastic. Thank you so much for everybody participating.
And thanks to, was it Scott who was trying to help me find the Benoit chopping the shit out of Flair?
Scott's a good dude.
Yeah.
Scott's a good dude. All right, so that's pretty much it. Of course, you can find us on Facebook, like Dave mentioned, facebook.com/turnbuckle throwbacks.
Woo chop.
Yep. Twitter. At T-Buckle T-Backs, emails turnbucklethrowbacks1@gmail.com, prowrestlingtees.com/turnbucklethrowbacks for the shirt with original artwork by Dean Stahl.
Hit me up so you can buy that Survivor Series 92 poster with Warrior took
again,
down.
He's slinging posters on the fucking show. Unreal. And
I'll
again,
nice deal.
BruiserBrody.com.
CrowbarPress.com.
Crowbar Press. Emerson Murray, thank you so much for coming on. And that's pretty much it. We'll be back next Wednesday with the big show. Black History Month is in full effect.
Next week.
Next week we'll start our...
We'll talk about black guys next week.
Yeah, we'll start our tribute next week, and that's pretty much it. So, our song, I have a song of the week. Actually, I'm taking... this is Bruiser Brody's All Japan Music. And I'll start playing that now.
Yeah.
If the fucking music. All right, that's going to do it for us. Mega Powers, have a good night.
You too, Phil. Why, beware the blue chop.
Another version of Led Zeppelin. Good night, kids.
Same song.